Seems like everybody's here. The Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order on August 11, 2023 at 5:00. Can we have roll call, please?
Kimberly Daly, present.
Robert Charles.
Here.
Mary Coonrod.
Here.
Cedric Davis.
Good morning.
Patricia Dobratz.
Present.
Lynette Hennigan. Polly Knapp. Megan Kramer. Adelisa Meek.
Here.
Diane Palacios.
Hello, good morning.
Mark Shin.
Here.
Antoine Trotter.
Present.
All right, thank you. My name is Adelisa Meek. I'm a licensed professional counselor, a licensed independent substance abuse counselor, and the board's chairperson. At this time, I would like to remind everyone to please put your phones on silent or turned off. For your convenience throughout the meeting, there are vending machines outside the door, and the restrooms are across from the elevators. A couple of reminders, this is an open meeting. It is being recorded, and the audio from the meeting will be posted on the board's website. If you are speaking on the record, please be sure to speak clearly and into the microphone. And in order to protect privacy, please keep in mind to refer to clients or former clients, including if they are complainants, by initials only. At this time, I would like to invite my fellow board members and staff to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Charles.
Bob Charles, public member.
Patricia
Dobratz,
licensed parent and family therapist, professional member.
Anton Trotter, public member.
Diane Palacios, licensed professional counselor, licensed independent substance abuse counselor, professional member.
Good morning, Mark Shin, professional member.
Good morning, Doc Davis, licensed clinical social worker, professional member.
Mary Coonrod, public member.
Kimberly Daly, licensed marriage and family therapist.
Aaron Yabu, deputy director.
Jared Carver, investigations manager.
Toby Zaval, executive director.
Marla Baskin, assistant attorney general, representing the board. Good morning.
Thank you. We will now go to agenda item number 3, review of past minutes. We do not have a quorum for items 3A and 3C through H. So those will be tabled. And do we have a motion to approve the minutes for May 5th, 2023, executive session minutes agenda, item 5A?
And Madam Chair, Cedric Davis and Mark Shen need to abstain from that vote.
Okay.
So about second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes approved. Next on our agenda item is number 4, consent agenda. Items on the consent agenda appear with a recommendation from board staff.
Board members,
are the microphones going up and on? Looks like I can.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. Board members have items on the consent agenda appear with recommendations from board members. I'm sorry, from staff. Board members have reviewed all the materials and the recommendations, and we are prepared to vote on each matter as it appears on the agenda. Before doing so, I will call each matter to see if anyone is here who wishes to pull the matter. Pulling the matter means that you are a party to the matter, you do not agree with the recommendations, and would like to up to 5 minutes to address the board. If you wish to pull a matter, please raise your hand so I can take note that you're here. And we're going to go to cases recommended for dismissal. Jara Bender.
I'd like to pull that.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Tressa Davis. Okay. Do we have a motion to dismiss item 4A2?
Palacios moves.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So could we hear from board staff a summary of Jara Bender's case?
Madam Chair, just in the interest of transparency and for the record, Ms. Bender has attended trainings that I've facilitated, but in no way do I think that creates bias or conflict, but I do want to put that on the record.
All right, thank you.
Yes, and Madam Chair, following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations.
Thank you. Do we have the complainant here? You may come to the front. Oh, the licensee? Okay, you can come to the front. Complainant's not here. If you could please state your name on the microphone for the record.
My name is Jara Bender.
Good morning, Chair Meeks, members of the board. Flynn Carey, counsel for Ms. Bender.
Yes, go ahead. You have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
I don't think there's much that we can really add related to the findings in this matter. It does not appear to be a violation of the Practice Act. I understand that Board Member Bailey has pulled it, so perhaps the best way to approach it would be for Ms. Bender to be able to respond to questions from Ms. Bailey so that she has hopefully a greater level of comfort about this one.
Can move forward with questions to the licensee.
Sure. Ms. Bender, I think I just kind of wanted to hear from your perspective why you think it's okay to have just kind of your pet at work and then interacting with the clients. I think I just need to hear you process that out.
Yeah, absolutely. So that day, I did not usually go to doggy daycare, and I did not have anyone to watch him. I was working all day. And he's never, he's a friendly dog. He's, I've had him since he was a puppy. He's 2.5. I did ask my clients that day, if they would be comfortable with that. If not, I would have rescheduled them. So I thought I was trying to do my due diligence in making sure that they were comfortable, and that client in particular said he loved dogs. He was fine. And so since then, my dog has not come to work at all. I'm not bringing him to work at all. I am thinking about getting him trained as a therapy dog so that I can then bring him to work, but that is not in the process yet. And he would not come to work with me until the time that he is trained and certified and everything.
And I feel like I read through the material that you had brought him before,
to supervision.
Or, yes. Okay, and with other clients here and there, or just supervision?
No, supervision.
Okay. Okay, I appreciate that.
Does anybody have any other questions for the licensee?
No, I don't have questions. Sorry, I just wanted to...
All right. Thank you. So this is the time for us to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. And, you have the case. Thank you for the discussion.
So I pulled this just because it's concerning to me that we would ask the licensee or ask the client, if they're comfortable with some change that we make in the therapy space. I would imagine most clients would say yes, even if they were uncomfortable, and wouldn't want to reschedule due to the therapist's situation. And it just kind of feels like there was not a awareness of what kind of position that puts the client in. Additionally, I feel like I read in there the testimony from the client that it was possibly going to be an EMDR session even. And so knowing kind of what happens in therapy, right, it just feels like it was a little haphazard, yeah, I'm going to bring my pet, do you mind? And then we had it all kind of go sideways as well. And that could have been really disastrous for a client. I mean, in this case, he's left her services. I think it could have gone sideways even worse. But I think I'm a little bit worried. I think there's just not the awareness of the impact of putting that decision-making on the client. So it really bothered me. That's the reason I pulled it. I thought we could talk about it a little bit.
I would just add to that, I think kind of the totality of the circumstances or the pattern that concerned me is not only not the awareness of that, but then sending the gift card. And so I think being really mindful of how all of our actions may appear to a client, right, from the client's perspective, how does this impact them or blur those lines or create discomfort or interaction or relationship then.
And I would want to ask in advance if any prospective client would have an allergy to dog dander, because a person might want to accommodate the therapist, but that might cost them a great deal.
I'm kind of you know, supporting what we're discussing here. I think that it was not a thing that was planned, you know, to be able to consider all the different elements that might need to play a role. And it was just decided on the spot because, you know, the licensee didn't have anybody to take care of the dog. So let's bring it. And clients are probably going to say yes because the dog's already there.
Sure. And the fact that this happened in supervision before me, it just made me think this is a comfortable practice of the business or practice. So I don't think there was that awareness of this might impact others, even her supervisees. I do not foresee a supervisee and say, hey, I'm sorry, this is weird that you're bringing your dog into our practice. I don't know if it was distracting. I don't know, you know, but it could be. And again, if we have allergies or fears, or we never know, right? This should be like the least triggering state.
Exactly.
For the client. And so I was thinking of a letter of concern. That's just where my head went, because I just think that we put a client and these supervisees in a really uncomfortable spot. And the therapist did not realize that. But I can go either way, just even talking about it on the record, what's makes me feel more comfortable that we brought attention to the situation and the impact it might have on clients.
Any other discussion? Do we have a motion?
I'll move that. I'll move that we dismiss with a letter of concern.
Do we have a second?
Go back, Becca.
And Madam Chair, just for the record, what would the language be that we would consider?
Just to realize that, you know, like the therapy space is not necessarily a place for our pets. And if we are, I don't know if you want to add, like if we are going to consider therapy dogs, you know, there's a whole professional process to go around that, including in the informed consent. That way clients know ahead of time what kind of practice they're walking into, and then they can make an informed decision ahead of time. That way if we do have issues or that just doesn't feel right, they can choose another practice to go to.
Okay.
That's very wordy, but.
I would ask if Dr. Bailey is okay, since it was her motion, to add, you know, just consideration of kind of the compromising situations that we may be putting our clients into.
Mm-hmm. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much for being here. So we move now to 4B. Cases recommended for dismissal with a letter of concern. Crystal at City. Randy Rodman. You're the licensee?
Yes.
Okay. And you wish to pull?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm just acknowledging that.
All right. Okay. So do we have a motion to...
I saw a hand at the back, Madam Chair.
Is there a hand in the back? Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks. All right. So do we have a motion to dismiss with a letter of concern items 1 and 2?
Palacios move.
Go ahead. Trotter first.
Palacios second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And we move to item 4D, cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. Jacqueline Keller. Do we have a motion to accept of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement for item D1?
Thank you so much.
Palacio second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And we go to item 4E. I believe Ms. Palacios needs to recuse. Cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. Andrea Morales.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, item 4G, cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. Janine Cossett. Do we have a motion for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement?
Davis moves it.
Potter second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Adelaide Sabine.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. Agenda item 4I, cases recommended for release from consent agreement. We have Diet Ayala Penalosa, Caris Marcellini. Do we have a motion to release from consent agreement?
Watson moves.
Trotter second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay. I'm getting there. We're going to agenda item number 7, a review of complaints and disciplinary matters. This is the time and place scheduled for the board's review of disciplinary matters. They will be heard by us pursuant to the authority given in ARS 323281. Those licensee or applicants on today's agenda receive by mail a board meeting notice, which include a list of potential actions that the board could take once we reach deliberation. This list is not exclusive, and there may be other options the board considers. Board members have reviewed all the materials submitted for each case. The board will first hear a summary of the case from board staff. Once staff is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional, will be given the opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask that those speaking do not take time repeating information the board has already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, will collectively be given the same amount of time that the board staff takes to present the case, or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. Once the board has heard from the parties, we will move into deliberation, and we ask during this time that you do not interrupt, as it is our time to talk amongst ourselves. If it's necessary at any time to refer to a client or former client, please use initials only, including if they are the complainant. And we are going to 7A. Jared Bender is the complainant here. Licensees here.
Thank you.
So can we get summary from board staff?
Madam Chair, just to reiterate, as previously stated, Ms. Bender has attended trainings that I've facilitated, but again, I don't feel like it creates a conflict, and so I just want to put that on the record for transparency.
Good, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations. However, following a review of the record, it does appear that ARS 323251 16M engaging or offering to engage as a licensee in activities that are not congruent with the licensee's professional education, training, or experience. This recommendation is based on the following. On 1/13/23, the board received a complaint against licensee. Since 8/22, licensee has owned and operated private practice. During the board's investigation, complainant alleged that client was a mutual friend of one of licensee's friends. Based on these allegations, board staff obtained client's clinical records to determine if licensee was ever the direct care provider for the client. During board staff's investigative interview, licensee represented that client was a friend of one of licensee's friends that licensee met one time at a wedding prior to client becoming a client of private practice. Based on review of the client's clinical records, it was noted that the informed consent documents that licensee utilized in private practice indicated that she offered completing FMLA, disability, emotional support animal, or other paperwork pertaining to mental health for a fee. Based on board staff's concern with licensee possibly offering these types of services, licensee was requested to provide various examples of such letters or documents she completed pertaining to what was listed in her consent forms. A 12/16/22 disability and leave health provider statement for client JW included the following in part. Licensee marked yes to the question whether the client will be incapacitated for a continuous period of time due to their medical condition. Licensee indicated the client was unable to perform their job functions due to their condition. condition, and licensee recommends the client stay home from work. A 330-23 disability and leave help provider statement for client MS included the following in part. Licensee marked yes to the question whether the client would be incapacitated for a continuous period of time due to medical condition. Licensee indicated the client was unable to perform their job functions due to their condition. Licensee recommends the client stay home from work. An 822-22 emotional support animal letter for client MR included the following. MR met the definition of a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Fair Housing Act, and Rehabilitation Act of 1973. Due to this emotional disability, MR has certain limitations related to social interactions and coping with stress and anxiety. Licensee prescribed MR to obtain an emotional support animal. The animal is necessary for her emotional health because it presents mitigates the symptoms she experiences. Licensee inappropriately completed disability paperwork for clients, indicating the clients had a disability that would prevent them from working, and opined that these clients should stay home from work. Board rules indicate that a licensed therapist's scope of practice is to include diagnosis, assessment, treatment, and evaluation of a client. Licensee further indicated in an ESA letter that the client had a disability and prescribed them an emotional support animal. Licensee improperly disabled clients in providing an opinion on the client's ability to attend work, extending her boundaries of competence. In addition to that violation, board staff also found ARS 32-3251-16P failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to the following: consent to treat and treatment plan. This recommendation is based on the following: on a review of client's clinical records, deficiencies within the documentation were found. An 829-22 informed consent signed by client failed to include two board minimum requirements. An 830-22 treatment plan for client failed to include the date when the client's treatment plan will be reviewed. It is concerning that licensee has been licensed with the board since 2015, opened a private practice, and failed to ensure all of her clinical documentation met all of the board requirements. Since the filing of this board, licensee provided board staff with update practice forms that appear to meet all of the requirements. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Zavala from board members? 5 minutes. Okay, you have 5 minutes to address the board.
Thank you, Chair Meeks, members of the board, Flynn Carey, counsel for Ms. Bender. There's two allegations. I'm going to go really quickly over the documentation one. A little different than I think what we normally see, which is wholesale noncompliance. The two items missing on the treatment plan, on the informed consent, were right to participate in treatment decisions and a dated signature from the behavioral health entity. So fairly compact issues as opposed to sort of overall inconsistent forms. Her forms have been revised and they were found to be compliant. So that's all I have to say on documentation. The ESA FMLA issue. She has only done 5 of these because she's only been in her own private practice for a limited period of time, so she was able to identify that it's a very small number. She puts a cost in her informed consent, which she has since removed, but to dissuade patients or clients from actually asking for this service. She's removed it, and she's not providing that service anymore. I think it's also, this has been a very educational process, and so I think what we're going to be asking for is an NDCA or an LOC on this issue. There is a bigger issue here with FMLA and ESA for the board, and I think it's a matter that the board needs to look at a little more globally. I don't think that disciplining individual licensees is the way to get where you want to go on this issue, and here's the reason. NASW specifically has guidance about these letters on their website. They tell you what you can and can't do related to ESA and FMLA. Federal law is broader than any other statement on this, and it defines a healthcare provider to include clinical social workers. So there's a Fed reg that actually says that this can be done and that, at least by federal government standards, this is a permissible act by a social worker. And the concern I have is there's a due process or a notice problem here. If a clinician looks at the regs and looks at the NASW, they would be able to determine they can do this, only to be told by the board process they can't do this. And I think that's where the concern is. There's a U.S. Supreme Court case called Granid, and basically what it says is we assume that people are free to steer between lawful and unlawful conduct. So the laws have to give a person of ordinary intelligence a reasonable opportunity to know what is prohibited so they can act accordingly. Vague laws trap the innocent by not providing fair warning. And that's the issue, is we have a fair warning problem here, because there's no document she can go to and determine can she or can she not do these documents. And in fact, there's Fed regs and the NSW saying, appearing that you can do it. I'm not saying that the board can't have a position about this. If you have a position that we don't want our clinicians doing these documents, there's a few options. You can do a substantive policy statement. You can go to regulation and say this is not within scope. You can go and approach this through legislation. I know those are not easy options, but it's also you're given certain authority by the government, and as a government agency, where you expand your scope or contract your scope is through those devices. And so my only concern is that having a licensee do this through licensee discipline, it does appear to violate due process. So those are my comments. I know Ms. Bender has some brief comments, and certainly I know you want to talk to her about sort of the logistics and what she's learned from this, and I think that would be a good exercise. I'm certainly here to answer any more legal aspects of this.
Thank you. Everything you just said. But so now I know what the board stance is, and so I no longer do it. It's taken out of the informed consent. I don't do it. I don't need to do it. And it definitely has been a very huge learning experience for me. And so, it's all interesting. I'll answer any questions. So.
Thank you. Do board members have questions?
I just have one. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think you had mentioned that your previous consent had language that was a high enough price to disparage people from asking for letters. Did I hear that right?
Not a high enough price. There was a cost to it, yes.
Okay. But it sounded like it was there to disparage people from asking for the letter. If you just wanted clarification on that.
Yeah. So I'm sure anyone in your practice knows that people come to me and call me, hey, I need FMLA paperwork, right? And they just think that you're going to do it. But part of the thing that's in the informed consent is that it costs $50. So it's not a huge cost. But I thought that it was a cost enough that says to somebody that is just looking to have paperwork done and not having real therapy done. And I also didn't do it for anybody that I just met, right? Like I had to have like sessions and stuff and then brought to me. So it wasn't like a first time, oh, okay, this is a problem, we write it out for you. There's definitely a process in it, so yes.
Okay, thank you, that helps. And board member Shen, you may see, I don't know if it's in any of the members' paperwork, but what I've seen in a lot of paperwork is legal, where it says either A, I don't do legal, or B, you're going to have to pay me for a half day of work at $400 an hour to appear in court. And so there is in informed consents, there is the act of disincentivizing certain things. Licensees I've seen put a very high cost. Some say, I won't do it. And they say, if you're involved in litigation, I'm not going to take you as a patient. And so I think there's a mix there. And overall, just because this can be a licensed complaint breeder, as we've seen, it has been removed from her forms. Thank you.
Dobrindt?
So can you speak to your training and process for determining that somebody is incapacitated and any validated measures that you need to make that determination in the writing of the
Absolutely. So part of the paperwork is, I look at it almost like it's like a DCS report, right? I get the information, I put it down in a file report, it's not up to me to make that final determination. It's up to the, Cedric is in the company, right? It's up to them to make the final determination. These are just my recommendations, is how I looked at it. I also know from my experience working in this field, licensed since 2015 and doing therapy since 2012, what it looks like when people have panic attacks. What does that mean when they have panic attacks? How does it impact their ability to work? Do they have brain fog? All those different things that we know that we need in order to be able to work. When people are when people have mental health disorders like anxiety or severe depression, it limits that. And so that's kind of my thought process. But again, like I said, I'm not doing it anymore. No problem.
I think I may piggyback on Ms. Dobrindt's. Did you take any particular trainings or classes on how to make this kind of assessments, or what is some kind of formal training?
specifically the FMLA paperwork? No, but I think all the training that we've ever done when it comes to assessing, diagnosing, and treating is, you know, I'm EMDR trained, I'm DBT certified, I'm trauma informed, I've been taking, obviously, trainings for years. So, again, not arguing that, like, maybe, you know, that I should do it anymore, I'm not going to do it anymore. So that's kind of my thought process. Sorry.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. So this is going to be our time to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt. And who's leading? Ms. Palacios?
Thank you. So we see this a lot come up at our board, FMLA and ESA letters, and our stance has been is that service is considered an assessment and needing particular training and needing to have that expertise. And we have historically said that if somebody's asking for FMLA paperwork, that that would need to be from a doctor. And so to coordinate care, to do an ROI, to communicate with the doctors. And so I think just continuing with that stance until things change with legislation. There's also a specific training on ESA letters and writing ESA letters, and I think discussing going out of scope. And so what we're looking at right now is a potential violation of the extending boundaries of competence. Now, does it rise to violation, or could we entertain an NDCA? So I'm willing to entertain an NDCA, but I'd like to hear from my colleagues as well. It sounds like she's learned, she's not continuing doing that in her practice. And so that's kind of where my thoughts are, but then I'll open it up to hear from my colleagues as well.
I have a couple thoughts. First, just for the record and the public and the powers that be that are listening at some point to this meeting, to Mr. Attorney Carey's point, the deterrent statements that are in consent are common, but they're concerning because part of this is creating potentially a conflict of interest, right? And to Ms. Bender's point, right, not charging a lot, but like, hey, I'll draw you in and do this paperwork for you, and now it's not as objective, but I'm getting paid additional for it. So my suggestion to clinicians, or what I think is best practice and more clinically appropriate, is take out what you want to deter and put your scope of practice. What do you do? What is ethical given your practice of providing psychotherapy? So just for the record, I think we've got to be really careful about those legal fees and things that we're putting in there to deter clients, because what it does is it opens up the door to say, but I will do it if you pay this fee. And so that does create potentially a conflict of interest. The other thing, we have talked about this multiple times, and I think where we have to be careful and why Attorney Carey's first two options for us creates, I think, an even bigger concern, is we've got to be really careful of taking a very black and white stance on this, mm-hmm. right? Because we're talking about competence and scope of practice. And so to say that there's no therapist out there that has training and has a validated process for determining this, right, and has it in their consents, like this is what I'm doing for you, and it's on their treatment plan, right? And there are situations where I think that it could fall within competence and practice. I don't think we've seen that yet. And so I want to be very careful that we're not necessarily going against what federal regulations say you can do or what NASW says you can do, but we do have a scope of competence statute that's very clear. And so our question for each of these cases is, let's look at, if you're providing psychotherapy services and that's all they're consenting to you to do, and that's all that's on your treatment plan, and that's all that your training and experience qualifies you to do, then I think we have every right to say that's outside of your scope of competence. So I just want to be really careful that we're not saying that we're going against federal regulation or that we can take a clear stance. I want to be really careful about that because I think there are situations and nuances that I just want to be careful about. So now I'll get off my soapbox. I'm also okay with an NDCA, but I think that those things need to be memorialized and that our clinicians need to really think about that, the bigger picture of what we're doing.
Thank you for that clarity. I appreciate it.
public member, I appreciate the professional members because you said the word nuance. There's nuance that I don't understand very well. But when I hear Mr. Carey speak about the federal regulation, that we don't have a substantive policy statement or we don't have legislation that does address this specifically, I hate to wade into an area where we are being technically maybe more punitive than would be prescriptive. So I'm leaning even lighter than perhaps you all would be, but I'm listening to the professional members and learning in a way that I want to make sure we're careful to protect the public, but also not be overly punitive in a way that isn't explicit for professionals.
Madam Chair, may I address Mr. Charles? I just also want to be clear, there are some documentation issues for somebody that's in private practice, which we've always, again, we don't necessarily take a violation on them, but we can't just look at the F and the ESA letters. We also have to consider she's in private practice and there's documentation issues. So I think an NDCA would definitely memorialize that a little bit better in education. Just my thoughts.
Yeah, thank you.
And if it's time to make a suggestion, I wonder if we could ask our legal advisor to give us a little bit of an educational moment on the issue, so that we include the issues that Mr. Carey's brought up, as well as our rules and so forth, and just make sure that our attorney is on board.
So, Madam Chair, may I address? Yeah. So, I appreciate that. I'm not sure that now would be the appropriate opportunity because we're in the middle of a case, and I think specifically what the board members need to do is we need to put this on the agenda for next month and have that discussion as a separate item. At that time, Ms. Baskin could have the time and the ability to vet with myself and possibly the board chair on an action that the board can consider. I think the biggest thing that we need to make sure that the public is hearing today is the board's position is don't write these letters. With that being said, we will be agendizing it for next month for that discussion. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I didn't mean to push for having it agendized for next month, but thank you.
It actually was already going to be after the discussion that we had with Ms. Meek and Ms. Baskin this week. I appreciate that.
Any other comments, questions, discussion? You ready to make a motion?
Yeah, so I'd like to make a motion for an NDCA. Do we do that and then prescribe what we're going to put? Okay, so that would be my motion for NDCA.
I think, Madam Chair, I think, Ms. Palacio, that the board members have agreed that an NDCA would be appropriate, so I think now would be the time for you to discuss what education you want to be in there, and then at that time I can memorialize a draft motion.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm thinking three CEUs on documentation, and three CEUs on boundaries.
Boundaries? Okay.
Ethics and boundaries usually kind of they're one in the same ish. So.
Scope of practice and boundaries, education, essentially. I think this is kind of a scope of practice thing.
Right. A good ethics CEU would include boundaries and scope of practice.
Okay.
And again, a good one.
Yes. Yeah. So that is my recommendation. I'd love to hear from others if anyone has anything else they'd like to add to the NDCA.
Is that your motion?
So, or you're still wanting? I'm wanting to hear if anyone else wants to add any other courses.
No.
So the motion would be that we'd be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. You'd be required to take three CEUs in behavioral health ethics. That would include boundaries and scope of practice. In addition to that, you'd be required to take three CEUs in Arizona documentation. If not signed, invited to a formal interview. And if not accepted, to remand to a formal hearing. Would that be your motion?
That is my motion.
Do you have a second?
Go back, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. So we move now to item 7B, Monica Gasper. Is the complainant here? The licensee. Okay.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
The complainants are on the telephone.
Oh,
it's hard sometimes when they're not here. Come.
Are they on? Hello, can you hear me? Hello?
Is
Ms. Anderson on the phone?
They may have muted.
Hello, is Ms. Anderson on the phone?
Yes, this is her.
Hi, this is Alisa Mink. I'm the Board of Behavioral Health Examiner's Chairperson, and we're here in a public meeting that is being recorded. We have the licensee present with her counsel and my board members and board staff. So first we're going to listen to, First we're going to listen to a summary from board staff. And then we'll have a chance to address the board.
Madam Chair, members of the board.
I'm sorry?
We can barely hear you.
Okay. Is this better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, so my name is Alessa Meek. I'm the Arizona Board Behavioral Health Examiner's Chairperson, and I'm here in a public meeting that is being recorded. There's public present and board members, board staff, and the licensee. So first we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff, and then we'll have an opportunity to address the board.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, it is not apparent whether this is clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to ARS 13-3620, duty to report abuse. And in all transparency, I do want to let the board members know that this was something the board staff did consider offering NDCA for. With that being said, due to that a minor was involved, we wanted to make sure that it came before the board so that it could be fully vetted. So this recommendation is based on the following. From 7/21 to 6/23, licensee was employed at agency, and her role included providing therapy services. From 10/22 to 2/23, licensee provided direct behavioral health services to client. During 11/28/22 session with client, mother, grandmother, and sister present, grandmother accused client of bruising child's arm, who is client's child. The 11/28/22 session noted that mother refused to allow client to parent child unsupervised. Following this session, licensee failed to file any sort of DCS report or follow-up in any matter regarding the allegations of the child presenting with a bruise. Pursuant to mandatory reporting laws, a licensee with reasonable belief should be reporting child abuse. Furthermore, licensee represented she did not file a DCS report because she reports no one in session was able to provide context regarding how or when the bruise occurred. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you. Any board members have any questions for Ms. Savannah? So we have the complainant. You have an opportunity to address the board, and you have up to 5 minutes. You can go ahead.
Step up, right?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Step up, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Oh, good. So you can do you have
that's right. I think they're clarifying.
Okay. Yeah, that's for you on the phone. You have an opportunity to address the board, and you have up to 5 minutes. So you can go ahead.
We specifically told Ms. Gaffer that Amanda had her patient had physically attacked me within the past 8 years and had physically hurt her daughter Samantha within the past year. My grandmother had also stated that Amanda scared her and had physically, she had heard from Samantha, her granddaughter, that that Amanda hurt her arm. So there was, all three of us were expressing to Ms. Gasper that Amanda had been violent within the last year and that we were fearful of Samantha, and my grandmother said for her own self.
Okay.
And when we brought this to her, she completely dismissed it in the meeting. She said, oh, we're not going to worry about the past. We need to talk about right now. Since it was a year ago, it's not important. She also just, like, completely dismissed the fact that my grandmother said she was scared of Amanda and was like, well, let's focus on Amanda. Let's focus on how to make Amanda feel okay. And we made the appointment because things had escalated to the point where we needed to go into therapy to bring this to our therapist's attention. And she just completely dismissed all of us and the concerns for her daughter's life.
Thank you. Do you have additional comments?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Do you have additional comments?
Just that during that same meeting, she had, Ms. Gasper had expressed to us trauma from her own past within the very first time we'd ever met her. And it was, I'm in therapy myself, and from my therapist, what she's told me is that you're not supposed to bring up your own trauma and your own life in a traumatic context within a therapy meeting. And Ms. Gasper was very open about her trauma when we were speaking about what happened with Amanda.
Okay, thank you. Do any board members have any questions for the complainant? No questions. So the licensee and your attorney, you have up to 5 minutes to do the work.
Thank you, Chair Meeks, members of the board. First of all, this case underwent a very significant investigation by board staff. Under the clear and convincing standard, there was not a finding that any of the allegations made were substantiated. I think it's important to note that the complaint that was initially filed had a number of allegations that were clearly not able to be substantiated, including Ms. Gasper arranging for free HUD housing, providing gifts to the children for Christmas, and a number of other things that are just not credible in this situation. It's a very complex family dynamic that Ms. Gasper was navigating. I'm going to push a little harder beyond an NDCA on this one, and here's the reason, because I think we have a licensee who clearly understands the reporting obligations. 2 weeks prior to the act where there was not a report, there was a report made. So Ms. Gasper clearly understands when the threshold is reached to report. This bruise that occurred was mentioned in passing, and it was a small bruise, and when licensee asked clarifying questions, no one could provide any clarifying answers. It was historical. It happened sometime in the past, and throughout the treatment, the complainants had made very clear that they even said it previously in their complaint, that the mother was not left, was never unsupervised with the child. So there is a bruise of unspecified origin that can't be traced back to any kind of abuse or neglect. And I want to focus the board on 1336.20a, which talks about not if you hear about a bruise, you report it. It talks about have you formed a reasonable belief. And that empowers a clinician to make a decision of whether or not that threshold has been passed. In this situation, your combination of your clear and convincing level of standard of care plus the reasonable belief, it does allow her to make that decision. And in a case like this, where we have a passing reference to a bruise with absolutely no information, it's not really what the statute's intended for reporting. So I think this is, given that she has demonstrated the use of the DCS reporting process 2 weeks prior in the exact same case, I think it's fair to say she understands how to utilize that process and has not committed a violation. I would obviously defer to her to make some brief factual statements. Just to put a bow on the issues raised by a complainant in her statements recently, you have the charts. You know what the charts specifically say. They appear to be accurate. They appear to be contemporaneous. And I think the board should not put significant weight on what the complainant has raised today.
Thank you. Go ahead. Thank you, members of the board. First of all, thank you for your time and efforts. This is a complex case, and so I know that it's difficult. So I wanted to address the allegation, of course, that I failed to report. And I want to assure the board that, as Mr. Carey said, that I fully understand the requirements to report abuse when I have reasonable belief abuse has occurred. I've made many reports to DCS over my time working in behavioral health. All of those reports were made in good faith and based on information that was provided to me that led me to form a belief that there was a chance that abuse had occurred or was occurring or would occur. In relation to this situation, I had made a prior report regarding this family. I had made a prior report just 2 weeks prior to the family meeting to DCS. And then in the meeting, which was a meeting to discuss roles and responsibilities and boundaries within the family, I was told about a small bruise that was observed by the great-grandmother of the child, who is the adoptive mother of the client, who does not live with the other adults, that she had observed a small bruise on the upper arm. I'd asked questions, you know, was it large? Was it painful? Like, how did this happen? Did you mention anything, you know, to the client? And none of those things had occurred. And so none of the adults living with the child at that time stated that they had seen this bruise or that they've witnessed any physical abuse of the child. In addition, the person who did bring up the bruise actually lives with a mandated reporter, so you know, I would expect them to have at least a passing knowledge of, you know, when abuse should be reported themselves. But so I could not form a reasonable belief that abuse was happening, given the level of supervision that the child was happening and the fact that there was no information regarding this small bruise that occurred. I did choose to document the bruise in my annotations only as a reference to ensure that if at a later time I received more information that led me to form that belief, I would then be able to, you know, make a report and have all of that information available. Otherwise, you know, why else would I document, frankly? And I do recognize my chart note, you know, could have been more clear regarding why, you know, I did not, more clear about the information that was not provided to my guests, is what I should say. It could have been more clear about the negative responses that I got in that meeting. But I take my role as a mandated reporter very seriously. And if I had gained any evidence that I felt that this child was being physically abused, by my client, by the other adults in the house, or anyone, then I absolutely would have made a subsequent report after my initial one. Thank you. Do any board members have questions for Ms. Gaspar? I do have a comment. So on Monday reporting, it's is not our role to define whether there's abuse or not. Our role is to report any suspicion. And so I do have a question about your decision to make the report 2 weeks prior. Yes. Like, what elements do you consider to make that report?
The report 2 weeks prior was a different type of abuse, and I received information that from a client that indicated that there was a habitual pattern of a different type of abuse going on in the household. And prior to that report, I actually spoke directly with my client. I explained that I felt like, you know, this needed to be reported, explained why, offered, you know, would she like to make the report herself? Would she like me to do that? Would she like to be a part of that? So there was a discussion about that, and she understood, and she agreed that, you know, yeah, this, I mean, the reason that she had brought it up in the first place was because it concerned her, and she didn't know kind of like what to think of it. And this is happening, and it's making me uncomfortable, and this is my child, and I don't know what to do. And so, you know, I asked further questions, I got more information from her, and the decision was made to make that report. But it was a different type of abuse.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. So this is our time to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. Mr. Shin?
Yes, mine. Thank you. I'll be honest and say that I waxed and waned a little bit on this one. I read it several times, and I'll be honest, until I had heard from the licensee today, I was convinced I was going to go a different direction. But you know, I just want to go on record and say that, you know, as a licensed clinician, one of the most important elements of your role is to protect your clients and those who might be in danger. So, you know, never fail to report when you have a reason to suspect that someone is being injured in some way. And never play the role of an investigator, right? Let DCF, let the police do their job, do their role. And to report when you have that suspicion. In this case, honestly, if a licensee hadn't done the previous report on 1014, I would be questioning her understanding of her role. Seeing that she did report and hearing from the licensee say about her rationale behind why she didn't make that second report allowed me to feel more comfortable with it. So, you know, before I make a motion, though, I want to hear if my peers have anything to add to that.
Ditto.
The thing that I keep looking at is, okay, so a report was made when, when suspicion was brought up to the licensee from the client, but not necessarily when issue was brought up to the licensee from other parties in the case. And it's like, I don't understand why one versus the other was reported, or why both were not reported. So that's kind of like my struggle, you know.
Sure.
What I was thinking when I was listening to her is the fact that she said no one could substantiate seeing anything happen. Here's a child with a small bruise, but no idea how it got there. I mean, children can get bruised all on their own, so I think that's one thing I was looking at, that there's no real, she wasn't given any real evidence or anything that this happened because of a person. It's just that, hey, this child had a bruise on her arm. That doesn't necessarily mean that somebody did it to her.
Are we allowed to say something?
Not at this time, thank you.
Any other comments before I make a motion?
Right, I think when we look at clear and convincing, right,
was reasonable suspicion. Thank you. Was reasonable suspicion there. And I think when you have a he said, she said, it's very difficult to establish clear and convincing. It is why our documentation is so important to justify why we do or do not do something. But I tend to agree with Ms. Cunard, and I just think given the information presented, I don't think we had enough to say, like, she didn't use good clinical judgment or follow her mandate, because I, from what I have, I can't determine whether or not there's reasonable suspicion.
Agreed.
Yeah. And just for the record, like we already mentioned, these issues are so important. You know, there's so many kids out there that fall through the cracks because somebody didn't do something like making a report. So just remember, and it doesn't matter, you know, we don't have to determine if it's a small bruise or a big bruise or, you know, a cut or a crack or things like that. Whenever there's some suspicion, it's just better, you know, like we already mentioned, to let the other agencies take care of that. So I just wanted to say that.
Yeah. And obviously when it comes to mandated reporting, there's no, you know, there's no clear black and white. Oftentimes there's a lot of gray. And a lot of times clinicians will come to me and say, hey, should I report this? My response always is, if you came to ask me to report it, you probably have a feeling that you should probably report it. So if you have a feeling about it and you have doubts and you have any questions about should that be reported, report it. And let the authorities and those trained to investigate do their part. Mm-hmm. So my motion, you know, I could go with one of two options, dismissing complaint with a letter of concern, primarily around just documenting. Like, document clearly your rationale for not making a report. If it doesn't get documented, it never happened, right? But I could also go with NDCA if, you know, some education would be helpful. I couldn't think of something to put into there, so that's why I'm saying dismiss letter of concern would be my preference. But thoughts?
I'd be in agreement with dismiss with a letter of concern. I did hear the licensee said that she did document that there was a bruise and that if she needs to come back to it, that it's there. So it does seem like she did clearly document that.
I think what I'm glad I heard from a few folks was that documenting what the process was, where she got to the position where she felt comfortable not reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part that made me feel better after hearing everything that we heard today, that she has the experience, she has reported in the past, she did go through a procedure to qualify why this didn't rise to that level. I would just want to document that better.
Yeah, the decision tree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Agreed. So I move that we dismiss complaint with a letter of concern.
And a letter of concern will state to document your decision-making tree.
Yes.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you for your time here. And people on the phone, you can hang out now. The case has been completed.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so we're moving to E. Ms. Savannah, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Daniela Aurora, is the complainant present?
They're on the phone.
They're on the phone, okay.
Yes, it's very difficult to hear, though.
Yes, we're very sorry. We're getting the system improved in a couple of months. So do we have LS and CS on the phone?
Yes,
Alice
is here.
Okay, thank you. So, yes, my name is Alanis Amig. I'm the Board of Behavioral Health Examiner's chairperson, and we're here in a public meeting that is being recorded. We have members of the public, and we have members of the board, and we have board staff as well. And so we're going to start with listening to a summary of the case from board staff.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations. Madam Chair, members of the board, you will note that in the analysis that was submitted for your review, due to the fact that our licensee was providing behavioral health services to the client for over 20 years, there's what we call a statute of limitations. So based on that, the ALS 3232516K in regards to multiple clients, whether or not that conduct occurred, it does not fall within our board statute of limitations. So I'm going to move off of that violation and move on to the documentation deficiencies that were found in our licensee's practice, private practice. ARS 3232516P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to consent to treatment plan, client record, financial and billing records, and telepractice. From 8 of 99 to 8 of 22, licensee provided behavioral health services to complainant 2. On 11-24-10, complainant 2 signed a document with an attestation that they read the informed consent, office policies, and general information. Licensee represents that she's in fact had a separate informed consent document back then and would give it to the clients but not keep a copy of that document within the clinical records. This attestation document failed to include any of the board's minimum requirements of an informed consent. In 8 of 99, complainant 2 signed a fee policy document outlining the fees for licensee services were $110 per session. 5 of 9 treatment plans failed to include complainant's dated signature, but licensee indicated on the client's signature line that she discussed the treatment plan with complainant 2. Furthermore, from 12-17 to 8-22, licensee only updated complainant 2's treatment plan twice, yet board rules require treatment plans to be updated annually at a minimum. The progress notes failed to include 3 of the board's minimum requirements. In addition, the complainant 2 progress notes met all requirements pursuant to AAR 461103, yet failed to include the telehealth requirements. Additionally, licensee's billing records for complainant 2 included the following concerns. From 112 to 221, there were 5 sessions where there were billing records, but no corresponding progress notes. From 512 to 221, there were 7 progress notes with no corroborating billing records. And despite licensee representing she discussed any sort of change in fees with complainant 2, the records do not reflect such conversations. Additionally, complainant 2 signed a fee policy which indicated services would be billed at a rate of $102 per session, which they were not. And in addition to that, it's highly concerning that licensee has been in private practice for over 20 years and has failed to comply with board rules regarding documentation standards. Since the filing of the complaint, licensee has taken numerous CEUs addressing documentation and has since updated her practice forms to meet all board minimum requirements. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Does anybody have any questions?
Hey, Ms. Sabala, do we know if the complainants were advised of the statute of limitations?
That is a great question, and they were not advised, as this just was brought to my attention yesterday. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Sabala? Okay, so we have the complainant, LS and CS. You have up to 5 minutes to address the board. You can go ahead.
This is LS. I don't have anything to add other than what I put in the report, quite honestly, I believe I was advised of all rate increases and treatment plans. That's all I would add.
Okay, thank you.
This is KS. I want to discuss the damages that Ms. Moore caused to my family.
Yes, go ahead. You have up to 5 minutes.
Pardon me?
Go ahead. You have up to 5 minutes.
Okay. It's my belief that Ms. Wall was working outside of her area of expertise and neglectfully and unethically incurred reckless behavior to a struggling patient. She neglected and ignored an obvious diagnosis. The patient trusted her for years. She encouraged them to have inappropriate and secretive relationships outside of a marriage. encourage behaviors that my husband was seeking to treat through therapy. I believe she did not have my husband's best interests at heart. I'm going to skip over the rest of the stuff I was going to talk about, but I want to say that the damages she caused are irreparable. We have a blended family of 6 children and 4 grandchildren that could have lost us both. My husband and I both became depressed and contemplated suicide, and never in our 61 years have we ever suffered with depression or suicidal thoughts. To this day, due to her suggestions, there's still worry on my husband's behalf that these outsiders of the family, these women that she suggested my husband take up with, we worry that they could jeopardize his career and reputation. Our daughter was with us when everything exploded in our family, and for months following, she experienced severe panic attacks and depression and eventually had to seek treatment for her PTSD. Myself, I experienced a deep depression. I lost 30 pounds in 6 weeks and was skeletal at 100 pounds. People were asking me if I had cancer. I didn't sleep for months, and I still struggle with insomnia. I had surrendered my firearm due to my suicidal thoughts and took a straight razor to my arm twice. Despite everyday life challenges at 60 years old, I never experienced depression or had suicidal behaviors or thoughts in my life. I could not do my daily chores and had to hire help come into the house to help me through my daily routine. And to this day, I still struggle with bad days. And every day, I look at the scars on my arms, and I'm reminded of the reckless and unprofessional advice Ms. Lohr encouraged my husband to take part in, because she told him that all marriages had secrets and that it was okay. My husband and I were so broken, we discussed divorce, suicide, and leaving the state. But instead, I suggested an intense treatment plan for my husband and an intense marriage counseling, as well as personal therapists for both of us that were reputable, a treatment plan based on open and truthful communication. And although it was costly, it is helping us. I have no background in clinical psychology, only common sense and open communication skills. This took me all of 5 minutes to put together this plan, but Ms. Lohr could not suggest anything like this in 20 years for her patients, even with her degree and licensing. I want the board to know the damages Ms. Lohr has caused due to her practicing outside of her area of expertise, giving reckless guidance to a struggling patient. And I'd like Ms. Lohr to apologize to both of us. And I also feel that she should refund his fees for her treatment, his treatment sessions. Lastly, I think her license should be suspended, fined, or removed permanently so she can no longer ruin other people's lives. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Do the board members have any questions for your complainants? Okay, Mr.
Sorry, I can barely hear you if you're talking to me. It sounds like you're in a long tunnel.
I'm sorry. Is this better? I was just asking if the board members have any questions for you. But there are no questions for you this time. So we're going to hear from the licensee and Mr. Kieran.
Yes, Chair Meeks, members of the board. I want to start by prefacing my comments that they are in no way a reflection on the client or the other complainant. I'm here as a legal advocate. I'm here as an advocate in front of the board, so I do have to make some comments here. Certainly, you know, I empathize with the state that their family is in. At the same time, clinical records over 20 years do not support any allegation that the licensee...
This happened in the last...
Excuse me.
4 years. I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
On for the last 4 years.
Right now, we have to listen to the licensee and her attorney. And if you could please put your phone on mute, we would appreciate it.
So as I was saying, the records simply do not support the allegations that were made. Inherent in the issues that the client was facing is an element of dishonesty, deception, and things like that. It's not surprising that that has pervaded this process, unfortunately. The reality, though, is that the charts simply don't support any of the allegations here. We were actually fortunate that there was a side allegation made about another client, and we were able to actually provably disprove that. It's why the board staff ultimately found that there's no support for the allegations that are made here. We certainly have some documentation issues here, but what I will say is, say what you want, the progress notes were thorough. You could track on again, off again treatment over a period of 20 years, see the development of this individual in his identity, in his getting triaged on the issues that he had. So this is someone who clearly was doing good work and not falling below competency. I want to talk about the documentation deficiencies. And the vast majority of them, including all the billing ones, are time-barred. I don't like to retreat to statute of limitations. I raise it because it is a legal defense, and so I do want to focus the board on what is good here and what has been done. First of all, the treatment plan was not just updated twice from 2017 to August of 22. It was updated 9 times on January 19th, 2018, October 11th, 2019, January 17th, 2020, July 24th, November 4th, 2020, January 8th, April 10th, July 15th, and 10-19 of 2021. So she is doing updates on the treatment plans. Her progress notes were extremely detailed. They were never duplicative. There's no cutting and pasting, and they include a significant amount of thought, and we could track this client through his course of treatment. We did provide new forms for her. We updated everything, and she has given those to all of her clients now, so they are all in compliance. She's been in practice for a long time, and I know there's a mindset sometimes that when someone's in practice for a long time, that the form and documentation issues are an aggravator as opposed to a mitigator. But I want to emphasize that she is effective as a therapist, and she will benefit from definitely some education on further documentation. She's already done that. She's already engaged in a lot of that. I think what I would ask is, this is someone who has shown her mettle over a significant career, and I'd like her to be in a position to be able to remedy the documentation issues that were not a source of prejudice in this case through an NDCA. Ultimately, this allowed the board, even if there were issues, to fully investigate this case, and I think anyone looking at these progress notes and treatment plans could say this would give another therapist certainly the ability to be able to treat this patient. And so I think that's really the matter here, is the deficiencies did not prejudice the care in any way, and so I would ask at least to entertain an NDCA.
Thank you. Do the board members have any questions for Ms. Rohr or Mr. Carey?
I have a couple of questions, Ms. Rohr. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that definitely the forms have been updated and changed due to this complaint, due to the awareness that has been found through this process.
Correct.
Okay. And how many renewals, I didn't do the math, I'm going to just let you do the math. How many renewals about do you think that you've gone through in your license renewals up till now?
Well, I don't know how many times, but certainly I have been I have a license in my profession here with your board since the license was allowed in Arizona 2004, I think.
As long as we got
right, 2004, I think it was. And I was a certified counselor before then.
Okay.
And so then I became a license when it was in. So every 2 years since then, it's 10 times maybe, roughly.
So during that process, at any time, did you read through, you know, documentation requirements? You know, did you read, you know, we had tests, you know, that we know what the rules are, we know how they change,
where, you know, we keep up to speed, right, with what's expected, and you know, we keep growing as the rules get clearer or whatever, you know, comes about due to, you know, whatever's needed in our field.
Yes, and in fact, throughout these 20 years that I've been licensed with your board, I've changed my forms as I, you know, usually when I do continuous medical education, I have a certain, you know, if you look every 2 years, I've been taking classes on, or courses on documentation and everything. I've been, and before COVID, I used to go to a lot of conferences as well. And so my forms have been evolving, changing, added according, you know, including the rules and regulations.
But up till now, that part's confusing to me, because up till now, though, they have not met requirements. So we've been, response to what you're telling me right now, it sounds like you think that you have been going to trainings and then updating your forms accordingly.
Yes, and I acknowledge that. I certainly do recognize that my documentation could have been much more accurate and much more timely, for instance, and I don't want to repeat what all the information you have, but I was looking at there are 10 instances that were in the report that I received from you that said that there was a date on the billing, for instance, for a certain session, and my progress notes had a different date. Mm-hmm. So I was very surprised. You know, I went through all of them and I checked them, and what happened was that all these notes were in 2020, and that was when COVID started, unfortunately, and so I started seeing patients at home, not going to the office, and I had an office manager for years, and still does today, does all the electronic billings for me, send it to the patients. So when COVID started, the two of us were not working in the same place anymore, and there must have been some problems. I wasn't aware of it, because I would give her information, and then she, instead of saying 3-1-20, she would put 3-4-20 at times. So she would make transpose or typo, or there was a typo, we never built anything that didn't take place, so it was always in good faith. It was a mistake. It was there was no intent to deceive or cause any harm or anything. It was just that we were trying to figure out a system during COVID. Now we do have a system, but during that time it was a little bit difficult, and that's when some of these difficulties came up.
Okay.
And I apologize for that. I'm really very sorry, because I realized that there were some inconsistencies in the dates of billing, dates of services, and everything else. I deeply apologize for that. I've learned a lot from this experience. I'm much more aware that I need to trust not only what I do, but I need to trust what my assistant does as well, because ultimately I am responsible for this. And I also want to have an opportunity now to say that I was very impressed by how this investigation was done. It was 20 plus years of work, hard work for you, trying to put everything together and understand everything. And the job was done very professionally, very thoroughly, very fairly. So I really do appreciate the good job you're doing.
Thank you. Just a couple other questions. Do you, in the last couple of renewals at least, the board tutorial kind of goes through a lot of specific documentation requirements. Do you remember reading some of those? I mean, do you remember that being part of the renewal?
Yes, you have to take it in order to yes.
Okay. And then my last question is, I have two more questions. One is, I think I read that you have been providing telehealth for quite some time prior even to COVID.
No.
Correct?
I never did telehealth prior to COVID.
Okay.
So there were very few instances, very few. My patients would say, I cannot come to the office, I'm sick, for instance, can we do it by phone?
Okay.
And so we would have but very seldom. all of the sessions were in person until COVID started.
Okay.
And my husband has a lung condition, and so he was told that if he got COVID, he wouldn't make it. So I had to stay home.
No
and
problem with that.
That's when I started.
I'm not questioning that practice at all during COVID.
Yes.
I think I surmised that you were doing, or thought maybe you were doing telehealth before, since a lot of your treatment plans don't have the client's signature. They just have discussed with client. We did that a lot through COVID. So, or, you know, when we're doing telehealth.
Yes.
And I feel like I read we didn't have his signature because it was over telehealth. So I might have missed.
The last few years were because of telehealth.
Okay. But we did have treatment plans prior to COVID that you said.
Yeah, I may have said that. I don't know why. I don't remember the particular occasion, but when patients were. But you see, I also, yes, I agree that there were times when the patients may not have signed.
Okay.
But it was always discussed verbally, at least.
I hear you attesting to that, absolutely, and actually the complainant as well. And then lastly, have you provided any supervision for any licensees pursuing licensure?
No.
No supervisory responsibilities whatsoever?
No, I never provided it.
Thank you. That was it.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the licensee?
I would just note, Chair Meeks, that she did complete a number of remedial CE. I think my count was around over 10. I think it's 14 credits related to documentation. And so there is a significant amount there, including the board's statutes and regs.
Thank you. So this is our time to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. Dr. Bailey, you're leading this one.
I was. And I'm moving to just the documentation issue due to the limits that we have on time frame and what we can and cannot consider. So the documentation piece is within our realm of timeliness. It's pretty apparent that we had a significant documentation issue at the time. It has been remedied, it looks like. I asked about the supervision piece because I would be leaning very differently if we had been supervising anyone. The impact of that would have been so great for me that I would not have been able to feel lenient. So noting that there is no supervisory role, this is definitely just, you know, her documentation piece and what she's doing to keep track of that. I'm good with an NDCA. I think the education piece is appropriate. I would just go on record to say please really participate in the tutorials. They're very clear about what rules are, you know, just check them off and make sure everything is in the form that's required. And at least those are the pieces that get completed when we're working, when we're doing our job, right? Because that's what's going to be looked at if the bare minimum, right, our minimum standard is met. So it feels like the few tutorials that you've gone through, that information has been there. So I am concerned that we did not, it wasn't, for lack of a better word, it wasn't important enough at the time to really reflect that we were abiding by the standards. Maybe some more education. I don't feel good about just the 14 that have been done. I feel like they were done in very small increments, you know, 2 hours here, an hour here, something that kind of goes into depth with a little bit more discussion back and forth. I think we learn a lot when we hear other people's situations, which is why group is so effective, and we can parallel that in maybe a process where we have more discussion. So I'm leaning for an NDCA for those reasons, but if anybody had any concerns I missed, I'm answering that.
I agree too. Anybody else?
So can I just move that we offer an NDCA that would focus on maybe a 6 unit all in one? So I would really prefer it not be 6 units cumulative on documentation and maybe best practices. Any other ideas? And if the other 14, cover everything else, I just think maybe one,
sitting, really delving into the issues may also, I'm just a little bit worried that we're seeing the information, but it's not resonating on how this applies.
Yeah. Do you think maybe instead of maybe the 6 hours I feel like might be difficult to find,
okay,
would the in-person requirement where you're like in person, potentially there's more opportunity for engagement and questions, maybe that would remedy it more than the length of time, like 3 hours, but in person? I don't know.
Yeah, it would be okay with
6 hours.
Mm-hmm. I'm just feeling that what we have right now that she has utilized, which is screen time and self-discipline, reading through, and then, bless you, and then applying the information to our own practice, right? We've had opportunity for that, and we still had issues.
Agreed.
So that's the reason I'm leaning into this, and then hopefully that's the answer we're looking for. So that would be great if...
And I think that we could add Arizona law because, you know, doing these reviews and you take those tutorials and like you said, they're not being applied. So, and I don't know when she took the last...
She just renewed in May, so do you recall when you took the last tutorial?
And they started, it's from January through April, March, April. No, this year.
Okay,
thank you. And that's before the complaint, so there was no action after taking. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, got it. Okay. Yeah. But I would also believe that she used those hours towards her renewal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're good.
But the complaint, we were aware of the deficiencies going into that tutorial. Is that fair to say?
I'm sorry?
We did go into utilizing that tutorial, knowing the complaint was, knowing these issues have already been acknowledged. Or,
yes, this year I used that to learn more because I wanted to make sure that...
Due to this complaint, though?
Well, this complaint was triggered it. Yeah. But every 2 years I do take tutorials.
Agreed.
Yeah, documentation.
So, Madam Chair, what I hear is that we would be offering the licensee a non-disciplinary consent agreement for 12 months. She would be required to take an in-person 3CEU on documentation and best practices, and if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
Go about second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the complainants on the phone. And this completes this case. You may hang up.
All right, I'll be in touch.
Madam Chair, can we take a short break, please?
Yes, please. We're going to break at 10:36 for 10 minutes. Thank you. Welcome back, everyone.
And use that language, just do the alphabet. And
so the board is back in session at 10:46, and just to let you know that Mr. Charles has left the meeting, so he is not going to continue today. Just today. Okay, so we're going to move to item 7F, Olivia Whitener. Olivia Whitener, am I saying it right? Thank you. Is the complainant here?
Yeah.
You may come to the front. It's Murphy, right? Okay. So first we're going to hear a summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16-G, failing to follow federal and state laws regarding the storage, use, and release of confidential information regarding a client's personal identifiable information or care. This recommendation is based on the following. From 11-21 to 9-22, licensee was employed at agency as a therapist. On 9-19-22, complainant discovered that licensee sent confidential confidential and proprietary company information with patient health information to licensee's personal email. According to licensee's personnel records, on at least 19 separate instances, licensee forwarded agency emails and client information to her personal email, which included the following in part: client's full names, addresses, and email addresses, a client's upcoming appointment reminder, a client's full name and phone number, two client summaries of treatment, which included dates of birth, diagnoses, number of sessions, and summaries of the sessions, feedback regarding three clients' treatment, and information regarding clients' insurance claims. Licensee represents she began sending this confidential information to her personal email for the following reasons: to protect herself from claims complainant may make against licensee. Licensee believed complainant was editing her notes because she would notice pieces removed after complainant signed notes. Licensee wanted to protect herself from retaliation and ensure the client's wishes for continuity of care were being respected. Despite licensee representing, she contacted board staff and an ethics professor to express concerns with complainant. As part of her ethical decision-making model, neither board staff nor the ethics professor advised licensee to forward client information to her personal email. Furthermore, there is no record within the clinical supervision records that licensee addressed her concerns with complainant. It is concerning that licensee believed it was appropriate to knowingly forward confidential client information in order to protect herself from possible future retaliation. On 3/9/22, licensee signed a counseling service agreement with agency, which included the following: licensee agrees to comply with the requirements of HIPAA and agency policies regarding confidentiality of PHI. Licensee shall use best efforts to safeguard confidential information and protect it from disclosure, misuse, loss, or theft. Licensee will not remove or transfer any confidential information from the premises of agency or electronically remove or transfer any confidential information from agency premises, network, or EMR. Licensee not only violated HIPAA, but violated agency's policy by electronically removing confidential client information from agency records and transferring this information to a personal email without prior authorization to do so. Furthermore, licensee acknowledged knowing that HIPAA laws prohibit client information from being shared without a patient's consent. Additionally, following the review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to the following. ARS 32-3286, unlawful practice. This recommendation is based on the following. From 11/21 to 9/22, licensee was employed at agency as a therapist. Agency is not licensed by the Arizona Department of Health Services. Therefore, any unlicensed person would not be able to lawfully provide psychotherapy services at agency unless they met one of the exemptions to licensure per board statute. In 3/22, licensee obtained her LAC license with the board. According to licensee's personal records with agency, she began providing psychotherapy services to clients at agency on 12/21/21. This means that from 12/21/21 to 3/1/22, licensee was unlawfully providing psychotherapy services without a license to do so. Licensee represented that complainant told licensee she could provide psychotherapy services at agency if she was working under complainant's license while her LAC was pending. Despite licensee representing that complainant approved this and that she was under the impression she could provide psychotherapy services as a paraprofessional, board rules clearly outline that someone who is unlicensed by the board cannot provide psychotherapy services in any capacity unless they meet one of the exemptions to licensure. And that is all I have unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Any board members have any questions for staff? Okay, so we go to complainant, Ms. Murphy. You have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Thank you. I just have a brief statement that I'd like to read. Members of the board, thank you for allowing me the time to speak today. I simply want to take a moment to acknowledge the very real consequences of Olivia's actions on the patients who were impacted. When I learned of the breach, I notified each patient whose information was compromised. Those conversations were extremely difficult. Some patients responded in anger, lashing out at me with concerns that their privacy never really mattered at all to her. One patient cried as she wondered why this had happened. I did my best to validate each person's concerns. I do worry, though, that those specific people have lost some trust in therapy in general. As therapists, our commitment to confidentiality is one of the most important parts of our role. Patients look to us to create a safe space for them. Without their trust, we simply cannot do our jobs. While we're all human and make mistakes, this was not one accident email sent to the wrong person. This was 19 emails. I take pride running my practice and holding my reputation in the community dear to heart. I was so saddened to have to even have these conversations with patients and to also self-report to the Office of Civil Rights. I hope that the board takes into consideration the impact that this entire situation has had on the patients affected and recognizes the severity overall. Thank you.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for the complainant? Thank you. You must step back. And the licensee and council can come forward. So Ms. Whitmer and then Mr. Kerr, you have up to 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Meeks, members of the board. Very briefly, I know Ms. Whitmer wants to make a statement, and then I have some thoughts.
Members of the board, I'm grateful to be here today. As a new therapist, this was a significant learning experience for me. I made mistakes along the way, and I am so sorry for that. I believe it is a privilege to occupy this position, a position where people grant you their trust, often innately without question. As a therapist, I believe I must earn and uphold the trust that clients place in me. I met the complainant in practicum and interviewed for an internship with her practice. During the interview, she expressed that she would like to work with me at a greater capacity after I graduated. I chose to work with the complainant because of her confidence and a shared foundational knowledge of family systems theory. The complainant informed me that I would be able to start seeing patients under her license immediately after graduation. I trusted her knowledge at the time, but I understand that the board has decided this was not allowed. I began to have concerns with supervision in April of 2022. I was not expecting the relationship to degrade in the way that it did. I did not expect that patient health information would be deleted from the record by the complainant. Upon learning this was taking place, I took steps that I felt protected myself and patients from the actions of the complainant. I consulted with colleagues and my ethics professor throughout the process. I emailed the information to protect client data and protect myself from retaliation. I have since taken 6 continuing education units on ethical decision making, 2 CEUs on progress note writing, 3 CEUs on ethical record keeping, and 4 CEUs on HIPAA. In these trainings, I learned strategies for note writing with greater efficacy and timeliness. I have developed a better understanding of the laws and regulations that protect clients and practitioners in therapy. I also learned how I could have put patient privacy at risk by emailing this information to myself. I see the impact that I had on clients by doing this, and I apologize for my mistake. It is a mistake that I will never make again, and I hope you believe that.
Chair Meeks, members of the board, there's 2 allegations here. On the unlicensed practice, Ms. Murphy was offered an NDCA for her role in that, and so I think looking at that one in a vacuum, it would make sense that that's potentially an NDCA issue. The reason I'm going very quickly on that is there's nothing I'm going to be able to say. An error was made there, and I think she's taken responsibility for that. I want to talk a little bit about the records issue, though, and this is something for the lawyers on the board. There's a little bit of a tension here because there is a recognition of protected oppositional activity. I'm not saying that it's the best strategy, and when I used to wear my employment lawyer hat, it's not the best strategy. It is a lawful recognition, though, that if there is misconduct and potential retaliation, you are allowed to take certain protective steps. She used a HIPAA-protected Gmail suite, so this wasn't just sent out into the ether. There were protective steps taken. And I want to focus more, stepping away from the legal perspective here, is sort of the optics or the situation we have here. We have a new licensee who leaves school, gets brought into a practice, and has someone tell her she can practice unlicensed, does not have the necessary training potentially when she comes in, and I think that it reflects on the overall training she received. At least someone's going to potentially have a very long career with this board. And so I think this is an initial significant, but a hiccup, at the beginning of her practice. And there's no evidence whatsoever that she made secondary use of that information. She didn't poach any clients. It was done, I think, with good intention, even if the execution was not what we would hope. I think she made attempts to get guidance. We did include emails to Ms. Zavala about her raising these issues before the complaint was filed. Again, she used a HIPAA-protected format. There was no improper use. She divested herself of the information and cooperated with complainant. I don't know that you saw the nasty gram from her counsel, but if that was included, but there was a counsel from from the practice. It was addressed, and it was, the material was divested. She took a significant amount of education on HIPAA, privacy laws, record keeping, and ethics. I think that demonstrates that she can be educated. And I think finally, you know, I put myself, and I'm sure both the lawyers and the practitioners put themselves in this position, is if when I came out of law school in my first job, if I was faced with an ethical dilemma of this size, I don't know what my if I would have had the skill set to navigate that with precision. And so I think that this can really be a significant learning opportunity. My hope is that we have an adequately aggressive, if you would consider it adequately aggressive, NDCA with some pretty significant educational requirements. I think that's going to allow this practitioner to fill in some of the gaps that maybe she missed during that initial supervision with the complainant and also get her on the right track. And certainly that will provide documentation for the public so that if this were or anything were to happen in the future, you'd have certainly the ability to aggravate.
Thank you. Any questions for the licensee or counsel? Okay, so this will be our time to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt.
Ms. Dobritz.
Yes. I appreciate Attorney Carey's advocacy for his client. I will say that the protected oppositional activity is a far reach for me, or a stretch for me. When you look at the information that was sent to herself, it doesn't align with what we may be protecting ourselves from, right? And so if the concern was that my supervisor is altering notes, the significant contact information for 19 clients just to me doesn't seem like you're protecting yourself. So I have concerns about that. So I don't, to me, that doesn't minimize or alleviate any responsibility. I'm concerned. The more that we electronically exchange information and store information, the greater the chance for a breach. And as a client or a patient anywhere, when I sign a consent, it's for that entity to store my information for the purpose of treating me, not for my doctor to then send to their own account, regardless of their account being protected in any way. So I have concerns. I agree with Attorney Carey that the oversight and clearly the work environment was less than ideal, and this is a newer clinician. So I was prepared, looking at everything and the education that's already been taken, to go the route of a decree of censure, which is kind of our lowest level of discipline, because of the significant amount of client information that was sent to herself without authorization or any, my mind, any defensive of taking that action with client information. So with the education that's already been taken, that's the route I was going. As Attorney Carey spoke, potentially entertaining the NDCA with additional education. I just don't know exactly what that would be. She's taken HIPAA, some documentation, some ethics. So I'm interested if my colleagues have anything to sway me one way or another.
Well, I had a concern on the email part because I think I read in there that she initially sent it to a
personal
email, then a couple weeks or so later realized it needed to go something that was more confidential. So I had a problem with that. As far as the practicing without the license, I think that's a dual responsibility, and she took she listened to someone who she thought had that knowledge and thought she was okay doing that.
Okay. Just my two cents. The whole practicing, you know, without a license, it's not a dual responsibility. if you're going to be licensed, you should know that you're able to practice what you're going to be practiced. If you have any doubts, don't practice. It's fairly simple. So at least over my time on the board, when we come across this, it happens and happens. And in my head, I'm like, why would they do that? You know, why would they do that? Especially in this particular profession. It's not like other professions. You need to be personally licensed if you are providing psychotherapy. Period. You need to be licensed to the degree of the therapy that you're providing. Keep it simple. Don't let somebody tell you anything. Make sure you know by yourself what you're doing, because that's the only way that you're going to avoid this in the future.
So, Trotter.
I would support, I think it does rise to a level of discipline. I would support a lower level of that. So your initial proposal, I would lean into that more so. It's a gross violation. And, you know, having to report, self-report that a HIPAA violation has been made is a significant process, and it does involve clients. So this also had huge, you know, detrimental outcomes, regardless of what we were trying to do for ourselves. And in our field, we put our clients' care first. So,
absolutely. You know, opening your own business is on your own. You can, you know, get ideas from other people, but you know, we need to get ideas from the right people that can coach us effectively. And we see that happens frequently, that people who are in private practice and there's no real understanding of what that means as far as you have your own business.
Yeah. Something I'm seeing too is that the agency is not licensed by the Arizona Department of Health. Mm-hmm. And taking on supervisees that are unlicensed, that's a concern that raised a red flag in my mind as well.
Well, and that's where we already found the supervisor was already had the NDCA because of allowing unlicensed professionals to work. Correct.
That is correct. And we found that out after receiving the complaint from the complainant that the licensee here was practicing unlawfully. But and I just want to just want to be clear on some things. I think it's important for the public as well. The board did take action on the complainant. It was an NDCA because it was an educational tool that we used, and I think that she was educated because of that. It was for a short period of time. If that was all that was in front of us today with our licensee, the board would have likely offered an NDCA, but it just goes a different area when you've got the unauthorized clinical records being sent.
Yeah, that's a violation.
I just want to be clear on that part.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. I'm prepared to make a motion unless anybody has anything new to add.
Go ahead.
I would make a motion to find for the violations 32, 32, 51, 16, double G, inappropriate use of confidential records, and 32, 32, 51, 16, double I, the unlicensed practice of psychotherapy.
That's your second.
And you're ready to provide your suggestions for it?
We want to vote on that first. Sorry.
Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
All opposed? Do I need another mic?
And again, given the education and the licensee statements today, I think she has learned from this, and hopefully we will not be seeing her again. So I would move to for a decree of censure. Do I need to add to
that? If we can add to that, offer a decree of censure and if not signed, invited to a formal interview and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
That's my motion.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Adelisa Mead.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Okay, so this concludes this matter and the parties are free to go. Thank you for your time. And so with that, we go to item 7E. Roller.
Is that right?
No, never mind. Close that out, please. We're going back to 7C.
Chair, do Melvin James is the complainant here?
Madam Chair, the complainant was not notified on this particular matter because board staff has not been able to communicate with the licensee, and that's why it's been brought forth today.
Okay.
We should call and see. To my knowledge, Ms. Northern James is not here, but I think we should ask the audience.
Is the licensee here? No, she's not here. So do we go directly to this question?
Yes. So, well, actually, I'll read the analysis real
quickly. Okay, thank you.
So, Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter comes before you today, and it's a very unique matter. I've been here for 13 years, and this will be the second time that something like this has come before the board. And so I'm going to go ahead and read the analysis. ARS 3232516-0, failing to furnish information within a specified time to the board and its investigators or representatives legally requested by the board. This recommendation is based on the following. On 1/17/23, the board received a complaint against licensee. On 3/29/23, a notice of complaint was mailed out to licensee and complainant. Licensee was given a response date of 5/3/23. On 5/4/23, board staff emailed licensee at her email of record, noting the response to the complaint was overdue. On 5/4/23, licensee responded saying she never received a complaint via mail and asked if the board could send it via email. On 5/5/23, board staff emailed the complaint to licensee and asked licensee to submit a response as soon as possible. On 5/5/23, licensee confirmed receipt of the email with the complaint attached. On 5/30/23, board staff emailed licensee again regarding the complaint and overdue response, giving licensee a 6/2/23 deadline to submit a response to the complaint. On 6/6/23, board staff attempted to call licensee at 2:20 p.m. and was unsuccessful in contacting licensee. On 6/9/23, board staff emailed licensee and copied the executive director asking for an explanation as to why licensee has not yet submitted a response. On 6/11/23, the board's executive director emailed licensee. On 6/13/23, the board's executive director emailed licensee. Again, on 6/13/23, was also reviewed on the psychology today and actually sent a message through psychology today asking them to contact the board. On 6/21/23, the board's executive director emailed licensee informing her that board staff were presenting information before the board for disciplinary action due to lack of response. On 7/17/23, board staff mailed and emailed licensee a subpoena to appear at today's meeting, and that was received, and as we can see, she's not here today. Since 5/5/23, board staff has been attempting to reach licensee numerous times, which have gone unresponsive. It further appears concerning that she is currently operating her own private practice and not responding to board staff. And just as a form of update, I'll let the board members know that this week, once again, I attempted to email at both email addresses. Neither email address is coming back, but it's undeliverable. I've also left a message at her personal residence as well as her professional reference. I also went to her board's website, or not her board's website, but her private practice website, and set it up not as if I was a client, but basically put my name in and asked to give a call. And to date, we have not received anything. So I'm asking for the board members to consider finding for the O violation and considering asking for the voluntary surrender of her license. Now, that might sound like a lot, but right now we are having a difficult time getting a hold of this licensee, getting her attention. Just to be clear, if you found the O violation, if you did ask for the voluntary surrender of her license, we would submit that to her the same way. It would be certified mail and regular mail to both of her addresses of record, professional and personal, as well as both of her email addresses. She would have an opportunity to respond to that again. If she didn't respond to that, then we would go into a formal hearing and at that time consider the revocation if we can't get her to respond. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Anybody else have any questions for Ms. Zavala?
I just have a question procedurally, Ms. Zavala. Just given the nature of the original complaint concerns and the complainant, if we do this, will they be notified of that outcome or no, since it's not in regards to the original complaint?
We would notify them of that outcome.
Okay.
In fact, I believe that we'd notify them after the outcome of today, because after today it would be considered public.
Thank you.
Ms. Zavala, I have a question. So after, if we go this route and it's sent to her via certified mail, you said that she has the opportunity to respond. Is there like a time frame?
Well, so what that looks like is it's very similar to a regular consent agreement in a sense. So you would ask for the voluntary surrender. We would send it to her. Usually we give people 2 weeks. That's a typical response time to let us know if they want to sign it or if not. So again, it gives her an opportunity to reach out. If she were to reach out to the board at that time, I think that we would basically continue the investigation and back before the board with that O violation. But if there's no response from her, we would just move on to a formal hearing.
Okay. Thank you. Who's got this case? Mr. Davis.
Yeah, what an awkward spot. As you can imagine, I agree with the concept. If I want to be governed by the board, then I respond to the board and I cooperate with the board. If I don't cooperate with the board, if I don't respond to the board, maybe I don't really want to be a part of the program. So I am willing to find that a violation now, unless someone else says no, Doc, no.
Anybody else has any comments?
It's my motion then that we find the O violation.
Quasi second.
Roll call, please.
Okay.
Actually, all in favor.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, all in favor.
Aye.
Roll call.
Okay, and now we are going to determine to offer
okay.
consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of the license. And
Doc, can I? I'm so sorry. Do we need a nay vote as well?
Do help me understand what you just said.
She had said all in favor, aye, but we didn't ask if there was any nays.
Oh.
Just to
oppose. Do you oppose? Okay. So now you can.
Sorry, just wanted to
thank you.
Yeah. We're going to. I move that we offer a consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of the license, and Ms. Zavala will add.
And if not, sign remand to a formal hearing.
Okay, that is my motion.
Chen, second.
Thank you.
No, we'll do a roll call. Roll call, please.
Yes.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
And just for the record, it gives me no pleasure to do that.
Thank you.
It's...
Yeah. Okay, so this concludes this matter. And we are moving to number 9. Ms. Zavala, do you have the number of licensees issued this?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, just a note, we've only had 3 weeks between our last board meeting and board staff issued 142 licenses.
Wow.
Thank you. Can we go to
the 9-0s?
Counseling?
I gotta get it out.
Okay. I don't know if people can hear me.
Thanks, Doc.
Okay, have it. Yes. So the Council and Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application of the following individual and recommends denial of licensure. One.
Bailey, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. Social work?
Unfortunate reality. The social work review board has reviewed applications for the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 8 applications recommended for denial based on a failure to pass the required examination. 1 application recommended for denial based on a failure to take the required examination for 9 denials, and I move it.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. Substance abuse?
The Substance Abuse Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application of the following individual and recommends their denial for licensure. One application based on failure to take the required examination. Total denial is one.
Bailey, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. And Marriage and Family Therapy?
Marriage and Family Therapy Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application for the following individual and recommends their denial for a failure to pass the required examination.
Dobat, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Do we go to...
I think we have a program to approve as well. So I would move...
A modification for correction.
Modification.
The one?
The Counseling Academic Review Committee recommends the following academic program revision for approval. Arizona State University Master of Counseling Program.
Second, Trotter.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Motion carries. Thanks. Ms. Saban, report number 11, report from the Treasurer.
Yes, Madam Chair, we'll have Cedric Davis review the June financial. 11B will need to be tabled as we do not have the complete financial yet.
And having reviewed the report, I will accept any recommendations other than that. I move for approval.
Do we have a second?
Don't grab second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Do we go to 12?
No. Sorry.
Yes, Madam Chair. I can start on number 12. I'm going to kind of take them a little bit out of order.
Okay.
First, I'm going to put Ms. Yabu on the spot and have her provide you with an update on the portal and the delivery of that.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. Don't have many words left after this week because it's been a busy week with the launch of the portal, but I think overall it has been successful, all things considered. We have had a variety of login issues, which was a combination of user error as well as just some unexpected things with the portal, but overall we've been able to assist everyone getting in who has called us other than a handful of people, so I think that's a success right there. We've had, I would say, hundreds of calls, hundreds of emails, and we are responding to them in under 24 hours, I would say within a couple hours for the most part. So thank you all for your patience. I wanted to say that publicly as well. So what that means with the launch is we now have a portal for applicants to apply for licensure. This would all be electronic. Of course, some of those documents would be required to be sent via mail, like official transcripts. We also have a licensee portal, so individuals who are licensed by us can now log into the portal and change their contact information directly there. You no longer have to submit a report and then wait for us to enter it and then look for errors, and I'm sure you all are familiar with that process, so we're happy that you can go in and do that yourself. You also will be able to make, as far as the licensees, several requests through the licensee portal. Of course, that consists of name changes, license verifications, things of that nature, and then of course you are able to renew online. So one thing to note, we no longer have the CEU tracker where you upload an archaic PDF document. You will be able to enter your CEUs throughout the year, keep track that way, upload documents. It'll make it easier for you all to keep track of your CEUs. And of course you have to keep your documentation for 24 months anyway, so hopefully that's a little bit easier. And then once that's completed, you will be able to submit your renewal online, which has been pretty seamless so far. So please, if you encounter any type of issues, let us know. We're working through the kinks as we get them. The vendor has been very responsive, and calls and emails have already started to die down. So the only two other things are the license verification portion of the portal is now up and running. That wasn't renewed at the initial launch earlier this week. So you can go online and verify a license as well as the clinical supervision registry. And then the complaint form is now within the portal as well. So it took a year and a half to get here, but overall I'm pretty proud. I hope this makes the process much more efficient for you all, and it certainly will make the process more efficient for staff once the dust settles and we actually figure out all of our internal processes. So thanks again for your patience.
I say as a licensee, I entered all of my CEs on Monday because that's the kind of person I am. And I got all my certificates, and if you haven't, go do it. It's just like it's cool to see it track it for you and put it in the different categories and upload your certificates, and just it's very nice. So. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your hard work, Mrs. Yabu.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add to that, I call Ms. Yabu Queen Thentia these days. This is all her. I mean, this has been a year and a half of her work, and it's been difficult because if anybody knows our board, we kind of want like a BMW style, and they were trying to give us like a Toyota, and I say that respectfully because there were a lot of things that we wanted that we had to fight for, that Aaron had to fight for to make sure that we got that. One of the purposes of migrating was because Microsoft Access, which currently held our dinosaur database, is going away in 2025. So whether you like it or not, we didn't have a choice. So we had to find something. But I think that we are still much further along than most other boards because we have a lot of details and information being collected that Erin had to fight for and literally program herself.
Wow.
And so I just think it's really important to say that I did nothing, and I think a lot of the other staff, other than just help her out and be there for her, this is all Erin, and she's been very supportive of this process, not just for our licensees, but for board staff, me being one of them. I don't like change, and so it's just difficult, so because it looks different, but it is exciting. I think the licensees should really like it once they have that time to go in there and get used to it, so thank you.
Yes, thank you. It looks really good, so yeah. Check it out. Check your information. Go in there and open it and make sure that everything's correct.
Thank you.
Awesome.
And then next we can go to a discussion regarding Ms. Zavala, Mr. Botts, and Ms. Meek's participation at the Counseling Regulatory Board Summit. Just for the record, I want to state that this is a conference that is held once a year. Our board is granted three individuals the ability to attend this at zero cost to our board or to the state of Arizona. And I'll just speak for myself. This is something that I go to every year. I always feel very honored to be able to be there. I always feel very honored to be able to represent Arizona. And selfishly, I always feel like we're always just one step ahead of some other states. This particular year, I was asked to do a presentation on ethics, which I really enjoyed preparing for and being able to present. And I believe it was the night before somebody bailed out at a session mm-hmm. for the following day, and I was asked to present at that as well. So this is something that's really important for us to be able to come back and utilize the information that we collect from other states in an attempt to make our board better and to make changes and to maybe think about things a little bit differently and how we can change things to make it better. So that was my input, but Mr. Bell, so speak.
Yeah, Ms. Dolbert, you have any?
I am thankful for the opportunity to go. I've gone as chair in the past and lucky to be able to go again this year. I think one of the things I continue to take away from the conferences is how different each state is. And so it's really interesting to learn what other boards are doing or how they're doing things. But it also normalizes the issues that we see and experience because usually
usually they have shared experiences. But at the end of the day, I think we get a lot of reassurance for how we do things in Arizona, and so I appreciate that. A big part of this conference was looking at, you know, compacts and kind of the move, especially for counseling, to compact agreements, and so it was really interesting to get more information about that. So, appreciated the opportunity.
Yes, and it was my first meeting, so I was really in awe about, you know, everybody that attends the meetings from different states and the knowledge that everybody's bringing. Really enjoyed the sessions, were very professional and to the point, and just so much good. And it was really reassuring that all the different states, although we're doing the things a little different, we're all working towards the same goal, which is protecting the public and bettering our profession. Really, really impressed. It was a great time. All right.
Madam Chair, at this time, if we can go ahead and go to a discussion on regarding the development of cheat sheets. So it has been uploaded to your portal. And now I wish I had them in color, but you all have them in color. This was just kind of an idea that we came up with. I think that, you know, one of my goals as executive director consistently maintains to be, try to be educational and try to make things easier for our licensees. And I know that when our licensees call and we direct them to the rules, they hate it. So what we did is we basically just took the rules for like a consent decree and we put it on a one-page document. Pretty proud of this. And I say, I just said we. I didn't mean we. I met Aaron.
very proud. We're very proud of you.
She put it on a one-page document, and I just think that it's, you know, I do think there'll be questions that are going to come of it, but at the end of the day, these are the rules. We're not making anything up. We're not adding anything that's not in the rules. We're not taking anything away. And so after today's meeting, probably sometime next week when we come above water, or I should say when Aaron comes above water, we will upload these to our website as well as post them on our Facebook. They're very, very pretty when they're in color, and hoping that people can use them. We have one for consent to treat. We have the client record. We have the treatment plan, and we have clinical supervision documentation. I actually sent it to some individuals yesterday who I'm doing a presentation with on Sunday, just for them to have it because it'll be public by Sunday. And they came back and said, I forgot the direct quote, but these are awesome. Are you also going to do one on telepractice for informed consent? And are you also, so we have a couple more things we're going to be adding. So we'll see. So pretty excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I honestly really appreciate this because this is a way in which we can support our licensees to not have to come to this room unless they're coming for CEUs.
I was going to say, as a public member, I read them. I thought they were awesome because I feel like even as a person that's not a non-professional, I can see what you mean. So for those extra, you know, sheets, like, I think this would probably be better. A good example would be for, you know, supervised private practice. I know we have a little, but it seems like that's another, you know, issue we have. So, but I thought it was very helpful as a public member. So great job.
And we do plan on continuing to market them at various, presentations that we do, like I said, also being on our website, and then we're hoping it'll just be black and white because of budget reasons, but we're hoping at our board meetings that we can disseminate them as people come through just for them to have. So
they're beautiful too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And then next, if we could talk about the discussion regarding the requirement of Arizona documentation requirement for disciplinary stipulations. This was requested by Mr. Shen to be placed on the agenda. And let's just talk a little bit about what that looks like. So oftentimes, whether it's for a non-disciplinary consent agreement or for a consent agreement that one of our licensees is on, oftentimes the educational requirements are for documentation, okay? And, you know, just for lack of better words, if we just said documentation and not Arizona documentation, people are going to be taking documentation classes from California and, you know, Kansas and anywhere else, and it's not going to help them. It's not going to assist them. And so we did make a change where we started specifying, you know, Arizona documentation. And I'll let Mr. Shen speak for himself, but I believe we did have one licensee that had reached in that he was reviewing the emails from our compliance team, that they had concerns because they couldn't find any Arizona documentation CEUs out there. I will tell you they're out there. There's not a lot, but they're out there. But I know that there was a concern if we were limiting them to only have a couple of classes out there available.
Yeah, that was my only, you know, reason for bringing it up was as I'm reviewing those, I didn't submit the finding those little ones that are Arizona specific. It's always like the broader ones, and so it was just sometimes hard to approve when I'm like, well, it doesn't say Arizona. I'm going to say no. I have noticed that there's a few, you know, training providers who are based in Arizona and doing documentation training, something, okay, well, hopefully you're focusing on Arizona. Mm-hmm. I know there's not a lot we can do, and we can't really, you know, recommend certain trainings, but I just wanted to bring that up, that sometimes I'm, like, not sure because it doesn't say Arizona specifically, so I do my best to look at what it covers, and hopefully it's covering what we want them to do.
And, you know, I mean, we always laugh when I tell people to Google it, but board staff, we can't make recommendations.
Yeah.
We never can. But I will tell you, when people call me and say, hey, I don't know, I just Google Arizona clinical documentation for, and stuff comes up. So it sounds silly, but people call and ask the board because they want recommendations, and I'll Google it and kind of go, well, here's what comes up when I'm Googling it. So I think I would like, you know, it'd be nice to see more CEUs out there in Arizona, but when they go on CEU for less, you're not going to get Arizona documentation, and therefore that's a useless requirement that we're, you know, having people do. So
when I think we changed the language that we were using, so I don't think we changed a requirement. You know, I don't think we're doing it more often requiring it. I think what happened was months ago, and I believe I agendized this, we don't recommend trainings, and we've been advised to not recommend specific trainings, but oftentimes we were saying NASW staying out of trouble,
yeah,
or similar, and it was like, well, A, why are we saying NASW staying out of trouble? And there were a lot of changes with that course being limited, and so it was, I think we started specifying more, okay, what does that encompass? It encompasses ethics and Arizona documentation. So I think that's where kind of the language shifted in terms of what we were saying. But I also think if you're providing trainings in Arizona or for our licensees, and licensees, if you're looking for trainings, they should be listening to these meetings and seeing what our concerns are and tailoring those trainings and what you're looking for to things that keep popping up.
Great. That's it.
All right. So, Madam Chair, also on the agenda is discussion regarding requirement of in-person clinical supervision for disciplinary stipulations. I actually put this on here, and then shortly thereafter, Ms. Hennington reached out to me and asked if we could put it on there. And so, traditionally, when somebody's been on a consent agreement, it has always been required for them to have their clinical supervision in person. And typically the same with therapy. And so the reason why I'm bringing this up, just based on, you know, the national lack of stats and state stats that, you know, in-person or online supervision is any less, I really, you know, wanted to have a discussion with the board members. Is that something that we want to continue to do? You know, I don't think if we're doing it because we're attempting to penalize them more and make them physically go into somebody's office and get clinical supervision, that's not right, first off. And secondly, if we have this impression that they're getting better clinical supervision in person, I have a problem with that as well, because we are allowing people to acquire hours for independently licensed in person. So I guess I just really wanted the board members to consider, you know, doing the online for clinical supervision to be able to memorialize that, if that's something that could be considered.
So that would be our standard language, but if we wanted to require, like sometimes we require the in-person trainings, we could. It would still be discretionary.
You can always require in-person therapy. You can always require in-person clinical supervision, in-person education, attending a board meeting. We talked about that. We haven't done that, by the way. All those things, you can always add to it if you feel the need that it would benefit that particular person more. But I think in some instances, I think it is difficult for some people to get, you know, clinical supervision in person, and obviously much more costly. And we're not here to, you know, making it an extra cost. We're here to make sure that they get rehabilitated and educated. And so just putting that out there, if that makes sense.
So this is a matter to consider that I need to...
No, I just wanted to make sure that we were on that same, kind of on that same page. Next, if we could go to agenda item G, review consideration and possible action regarding the active restrictive status. Members of the board, I did upload a document that was submitted by Flynn Carey, and if you recall correctly, at our last board meeting, there was a public comment made by a member of one of Mr. Carey's attorneys in his practice. I apologize, but presented to the board that there was some concerns about using the active restricted status on an individual's license when they were under a disciplinary consent agreement. Again, there was the document that was uploaded on it, and that seems to, I have a little bit more to say, but I do think in this particular instance it may not be a bad idea for our board to hear from Mr. Carey since he is here today. It's not something that we typically do, but I think it makes sense. But I kind of want to talk a little bit about this, a little bit about what Mr. Carey wrote in here, and just a little bit about some things that I collected. I think that he's right, and I think it's fair in saying that I did say this is something we've always done. And my point in saying this is something we've always done was that it's never been a problem. I've been here since 2010. Nobody's ever raised this issue. Typically, when people are having a difficult time finding a job, it's not because of the status. It's because of what the consent agreement says that they did in the findings of facts. And so I've never had that come up. I also know that nationally, when I was at our national conference a few weeks back, I did bring this up, and I believe there were 33 states represented, and I would just say it was all over the board. Some use active restricted, some use restricted with something, some use probation. There's all sorts of things. So there's no standard language. I also reached out to four of our health boards here at the board just to, because I want to make sure that we're not doing something that's different or that's wrong. The nursing board and the medical board came, that they have a different language that they use. One uses active probation, but specifically the DO board uses active with restrictions, which I think active restricted means the same thing. So my point in bringing all this up is that I think that we align with other boards. I think we align nationally with what we determine that we call it. We are just letting the public know that this person's license is active, but there's restrictions on it. This person has to get clinical supervision in order to be providing psychotherapy. This person has to get the education required in order for them to be providing psychotherapy. So that's what I have. Again, Madam Chair, I do think that since Mr. Carey is here today, it makes sense for the board members to hear from him. And just for the board members, if you're thinking about, if you're thinking about making the change, what that looks like is that, with direction from our board members, we'd have to go, with Queen Thentia to have her change that status. So I'm not going to say it's a lot of work or it's not a lot of work. It's a status change. I do have a concern making that change for one individual. I also have that concern, the fact that we have been doing it since 2004. I can only represent since 2010. It hasn't caused an issue. I'm not sure why we would make that change, but those are just my points.
How does it end? Reviewing Mr. Carey's letter again. How the board stands on how this impacts the National Practitioners Databank. Like, the language that then is reported there, does it carry over directly from the language that we use? Or
You know, I actually think that Mr. Carey has done, you know, more of an examination on that part, but when I read his letter, I'm seeing that he agrees with everything Howard reports to MPDB. There's no issue there. It's just what we are putting. When I say active status, what that means is if we were to go, and I'll use Mr. Rose as an example, since this is a, you know, public hearing or a public meeting, is that if you were to go and do a verification of her and you put her name in, it's not going to say active like Patricia DeBots does. It's going to say active restricted, and then you click on it, and then you're going to be brought to a link of where that consent agreement is. So if I'm understanding your question, I don't think it's an issue with MPDB.
Well, I'm not sorry, I guess, Mr.
Come on over.
Is it regardless of how we define it here, is it always going to show as probation of licensee in the National Practitioner's Data? Is that what you're researching?
Yes, so the way that MPDB is code-based, so what you do is you enter, when there's a violation, you enter in a code, and there's basically a book an MPDB book, it's online, it's called the MPDB Handbook, we use it as practitioners, and you code, so when you order someone to be disciplined, Toby or her staff will look at it, they will assign a code number. So if you suspend someone, there's a special code for suspension. If you put someone on probation, there's a code for probation. The medical board, for instance, if you actually do put someone on what's called a practice restriction, you can't prescribe controlled substances, there is a practice restriction code that is used. And this is where the glitch kind of is for what I'm seeing, is we're getting into a position now where everything is electronic. The MPDB is out there. The board, as far as I can tell, is doing MPDB correctly and using the proper probation codes. But we have Arizona law in front of the medical board in multiple medical board cases where the Court of Appeals is using the term restriction to mean a inability to do certain scopes or areas of practice. And the reason that's important is, unfortunately, some of the insurance companies are using practice restrictions as a way to get rid of a doctor off of their rolls. They make them uninsurable in some instances because of practice restrictions, because that's not something that a health plan can necessarily police. So restriction does have a term of art that is used. And the reason it's on my radar is both me and several of my colleagues, we have to often send letters to physician groups, to hospitals under privileges. We have to send it to health plans, and we have to send it to some of the board certifications that some of these professionals get, because they are confused when they see probation even. They say, well, what does that mean? Does this mean this person has a practice restriction? Because under our bylaws, our rules, if you have a practice restriction, you cannot practice here. And so we've had to do that dance a lot. And what I'm seeing is, at least I have anecdotal evidence from a client about the people seeing the word restriction. And I'm here solely representing her. I'm not here to affect, you know, system-wide change, although I think you have to if you agree with my analysis, out of fairness. But the concern that I have is restriction has taken on a term of art throughout the insurance industry, the bylaws that we see in all the hospitals, and through many of the boards. And I will tell you just anecdotally, one of the hardest fights I have against the medical board, for instance, is they want to put a practice restriction on a client, because that is the death knell. You can't readily practice in a hospital. You can't readily practice in a lot of settings when you have what is perceived to be a practice restriction. And so what I'm seeking through this case, but also obviously for your consideration, you'll consider this more globally, is if we're using the MPDB to speak to probation, which is not a restrictive status, even though they have stuff that someone has to do, they're not being restricted in their population focus, the hours of practice, anything like that, I think there should be some uniformity in the database as well. And I think it's a simple change to active discipline, so the person knows that there's an active discipline currently pending on this person. You know, that's a fair easy to do it. And then once they fall off of discipline due to completion of probation or whatever, there is a yes-no for discipline further over in the columns. So there is an opportunity. Someone will always see that there's discipline there. And so switching it to an active discipline, for instance, or something along those lines, I think gets you where you want to go. I just think restriction, any kind of the restriction word is taking on or has a term of art in at least two of the cases that we've provided you, and I can tell you as a practitioner in the healthcare space throughout, restrictions are something that we have to really be careful about. And because, and with informatics and how much the tech has occurred, and even with the database now coming up, which is going to be more, hopefully more usable by members of the community, it's something we do need to, I think, police a little bit more carefully. And so that's where my comments came from. And I'm certainly bringing it to you in front of in a particular instance where it's occurred, but I can't speak to if this is affecting other people. I just know that I have a term that I would not normally expect to see in a database for someone who doesn't actually have a practice restriction.
How do you reconcile, like, if I'm an employer, right, and I am looking at the database, or I'm looking at the upper actions and the board's website, I would want to know if somebody can only practice under clinical supervision, or if we've said in a consent agreement they can't practice in a supervised private practice, or they have to practice at a licensed agency. Like, to me, that is a practice restriction, and I would want to know that.
Well, I think you have to go back to the document itself, and that's one of the issues, is that when you have an active restricted in a column, I think that is highly problematic, that because it doesn't always invite someone to click through and review the agreement. I think that that it should be in the consent agreement. I just think saying that that's a restriction, it's very different. You know, at least the court says that what a restriction is a limitation on the scope of practice, the means of practice. Having to go and speak with a clinical supervisor is not normally seen as a practice restriction.
But I believe that it's a restriction on being an independently licensed clinician.
Not as the courts have used it. They have generally, the cases that we've had from Arizona speak to an individual who is not able to prescribe controlled substances, requires a chaperone in their rooms, can't see female patients, things like that. That is restrictive as to their population focus. And that's the language that we're normally seeing in these cases, is it's directed towards limitations on the scope. The fact that you have other people you need to consult with, you know, things like that, has not generally been treated as a practice restriction. And that's the concern, at least for this board. What I'm seeing is, when I see restricted, it has taken on a term of art. So that's where that comes from.
So you're saying when somebody looks at that and sees active restricted, they're a lot of times not willing to even look at what that restriction is. They're just rejecting them immediately because of that.
I have anecdotal information from a case, and that's why I'm bringing it to the board. I'm not here trying to speak to a globally, but I have a client who has reported that this is what was conveyed to her, and as a result, I bring it to the board for discussion. That has created an obstacle, and I think it should not have created an obstacle. And, you know, there are always, of course, with anyone who's applying for a job, there may be other things in factor, but this is the first time I've had someone report to me that was something that was conveyed to them. So I bring it to you, I've looked at it, and I believe it is incorrectly labeled as a restriction when someone is merely on the probation agreement and does require to check in with a clinical supervisor.
Madam Chair, can I just add something? I also want to just be clear. I did supply Mr. Carey and his client an email documentation stating that, you know, she wasn't restricted in practicing. So that felt like it would do the job, a letter from the ED stating that there was no restrictions on her practicing. That's all I wanted to say.
Would we be able to differentiate, because what we've talked about, Mr. Bott said, is sometimes we do have practice restrictions. You can't do supervised private practice. You can't do private practice. Would that be too messy to differentiate active restricted versus active disciplinary?
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely not comfortable as a public member having the active restricted removed entirely, because a lot of the CAs we have, it's restrictions. It's restrictions. You have to practice with adult, you know, clients. You have to, you know, practice under direct supervision. Like, that's restrictive. There's no other way of looking at it. The court has its place, but here, it's restrictive. So I'm comfortable with that, but for certain instances, your CAs without those restrictions, I mean, that's an open question. But I don't think I'm comfortable removing the active restricted. I think I'm just more comfortable that depending on the CA, we might have an active probation or active something else to kind of delineate the two so that, you know, one obviously has, you know, restrictions and one doesn't. Since it's one case that we've heard, or at least, you know, since my time here, but one case we have heard is very rare, but I think the point, it seems like something that we can do, in my opinion.
I think the only, and I don't know if I can't speak for the staff, but because I was playing around with this idea in my head as well, but I think the issue is we have somebody who's under clinical supervision on a CA for the first 12 months and then at the discretion of the clinical supervisor, and so then are we also saying that at the end of those 12 months, board staff is going to go in and change the status of that from restricted to now just probation for the second 12 months? So I think it gets kind of messy. And I think the only thing that would qualify for then just literally probation would be those that are just doing education, maybe therapy too. But
I think my comment, just to clarify for the board, is not necessarily that the what's on that little box needs to necessarily start controlling all of this or being changed constantly. It's that we want to, I think the behavior I would hope to discourage, at least in my client's case, is someone seeing that and not clicking through and actually reviewing an active consent agreement. I mean, I don't think it's ever appropriate if you're taking on a licensee as a employer who has a consent agreement not to be reviewing that consent agreement. I think that's just good practice. I think that's well within the scope of what you do as independently licensed folks who have a sub-licensee or a dependent licensee. I think it's just to discourage someone from treating that as the words of the board, because it's not. The way the board speaks is through its consent agreement or through its orders. And so I think the idea is to change the user behavior from looking at that and treating that as a legal determination and instead clicking through. If you go look at, for instance, a medical board, what you'll see is when you pull up the person's profile, you immediately get the board orders entered. And if you do click through to your board, you actually click that one box, you actually get a nice little description of the violations and of the ability to click further even more and get the physical document. Ditto with the nursing board, you click on nurses, which is a proprietary, it's for the nursing compact because nurses practice everywhere. You click it and it says history, and then you can go in and see what it is and then click it again and get into the information. I just think that there's a user behavior issue that's been recorded to me, and I bring it to you, just that people are getting confused about that term as it's showing up. And that active-restricted is not the words of the board. That is not the board speaking. The board speaks through its orders. And so I think it's just to discourage someone from taking that as some sort of finding, and instead encouraging them to actually click one button and get into the box that says exactly what those board orders look like. And at that point, you know, the board, I think, has always been very accurate in both its reporting and actually in how it shows up on the board website.
I think it's assuming that it's not our language when I'm not sure that, I think active restricted is our language from this discussion for the most part. So I think changing it for an anecdotal one or two instances user, I mean, if we had board staff develop new processes and procedures to tailor it to every user we have out there, we would have Ms. Yabu clone a million times to do that. So I worry about doing it just for something like that.
I would also add it just, and Mr. Carey just re-emphasized it, if we are addressing that someone is not looking at the consent agreement due to the language, taking the language off, they're not going to look at the consent agreement. So we would be opening it up, and just using that philosophy, there would be many more cases where somebody would see that there's no restrictions and then move on and never look at the consent agreement. agreement to see that there are restrictions. So it feels like that philosophy for me, I immediately see the back end of that, and that's more problematic than the few little.
Well, it's not I'm not proposing deleting. I think it's to flag it in some way that something is actively happening with the person's license.
No, I'm sure. I apologize for interrupting. As the executive director, I feel like I have to kind of step in now. I wasn't anticipating me going back and forth. With that said, I think if you are considering making the change, you know, give board staff the opportunity to collect more information. I have big concerns about making this change for one individual. If it was global, absolutely we have a problem and we need to fix it. So, you know, respectfully, I appreciate, you know, the concerns that Mr. Rice has. I appreciate, you know, Mr. Carey's time that he's put into this. But if we're going to make this change, this is not, it's a simple change, but it's not a simple change. And so if you're even considering it, which is troubling for me with one person having this issue, we're here to protect the public. We need to let people know that their license is restricted, and it is. And if you open up our law, I think there's three different places where they use the word restricted, and so I'm not sure what other word we'd be using. So I just don't think, I want to be careful because we've got the public here, and I want to make sure the public understands they can't come in and go back and forth with our board members. No disrespect to you. I think having him here would be able to ask questions, but I think that you hear it. So if you want to direct board staff to collect more information, we'd be happy to do that for you. I don't know what that looks like out there, by the way, but we will.
The only thing that I would be interested in seeing, if my colleagues, is, I mean, I'm not sure we can make it any more easy from what I've seen, but like to get to the consent agreement, I guess, or the adverse action, if there's more of a preview or something that can pop up. I mean, if we're trying to encourage people to review it, I care more about that than I do anything with the language. I like our language that we use. I think it does represent what we're doing.
So. Well, a couple of things to consider is when somebody is on a consent agreement, they are required to notify their employer within 30 days. So if that employer were to hire somebody and not be aware, which a lot of them don't, by the way, they don't do their due diligence and go and look to see if there's past or current. And if they do, then and if they don't, I should say, within 30 days of that change of employment, that licensee has to have them sign and acknowledge that they're aware that they're on a consent agreement. And I think if you were to read through the entire consent agreement as it stands, regardless of the status, it's very clear that they can practice, that they have restrictions on their license if they're going to practice.
Thank you, everyone. I am not comfortable changing the language at this time, and it seems like my colleagues finishing that sentence.
Okay, I would say for the public going forward, if you run into this, reach out to the executive director, and depending on what your consent agreement is, she'll have to provide you a letter just if it happens again as a one-off type of situation. Is that fair advice that we should be giving to the professionals in the space? If they run into a situation, to contact board staff to see see if there's something?
I'm just trying to wrap my head around that because I think it's clear on the order, on the consent agreement, you know.
Okay.
The language is really clear, and we refer to it all the time when we're reviewing different things, and we have to most clearly specify there.
My employer, or potential employer, didn't want to take the time to read a few pages. I have concerns about working for them at that point. I do. It's really about that, so.
Do you have anything else for us?
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, next on the agenda is 12C, an update on the rulemaking package, and then we also have a ratify motion that needs to be had. But I just want to update on the rulemaking package just a little bit. And just because the public being here, I think what I want to do first is just read the minutes from our July 31st special meeting that we had. Ms. Zavala updated the members regarding the rule package that is currently in front of the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. She showed the Governor's Office has advised the Board to terminate the rule package at this time. They are committed to working with staff to develop a more comprehensive rule package that will add additional public protections. Zeta Didolf Percoro, Governor's Health Policy Advisor, shared with the Board that they were supportive of the proposed rules and they will work with the Board on a new rule package and submission to GERC so that the proposed package has a greater chance chance of approval by GIRC. So what I want to share just a little bit with you on that is that the board went through a very transparent year and a half rulemaking process, extensive amount of work from board staff as well as the various associations in regards to what that looks like. There's a number of things that are put in place for us to develop or modify rules that we have. We went through two public hearings, and then at the end we end up at GIRC. There was one particular rule that was brought up. Again, towards the end, there was a whole bunch of rules that came up. But there was one particular rule that there was a very small a group of individuals that was contentious in regards to changing for supervised private practice based on the concerns that we have with individuals at the associate level opening up a business practice, providing psychotherapy to the most vulnerable clients in the state of Arizona. And so based on the concerns that our board had over multiple issues with compliance in that particular program, we were recommending that the 1-to-20 ratio change to 1-to-10. And unfortunately, you know, going in front of GIRC, not just once, not just twice, but four times, unfortunately, we had to end up with a withdrawal. And the questions that they were asking were things that nobody had the answer to. They were questions like, how can you prove that having somebody be supervised more often, more frequently, was going to protect the public? I don't know how to answer that. You know, I will tell you, and I know that you will say it's not true, but I feel like a failure that we weren't able to get this package through. I think it's super unfortunate because there were so many rules in that package that were so beneficial for licensees and for applicants. And because we weren't able to withdraw one rule, we had to withdraw the whole rule package, and we have to start all over. So that's the negative. The positive is the governor's office over the weekend, beginning on Friday night at our NBCC conference, got heavily involved and worked with me through the weekend in basically expressing the fact that they were very supportive of the rules that we had there. It just didn't make it. They were also very supportive in the concerns that we have in regards to supervised private practice and allowing people at the associate level to practice privately. And we are going to be working with them after we get through Fentia and the budget and our audit. We're going to be working with them to have a really what we'd want to consider a more robust rule package that will include more parameters around that supervised private practice, as well as hopefully the current rules that are set forth, that were set forth, and then possibly even some additional rules that we can think of between now and then that will be a benefit to our licensees and to the people of Arizona. So I don't know if anybody has any questions on that. I don't know if I can answer any questions on that. It was a pretty rough process, and I do think it's very unfortunate, but it happened, and so now we just have to pick it up and move forward and you know, continue to do what we do best, and that is to carry out the mission of the board.
It's incredibly disappointing that there did not appear to be the option to address the one rule that seemed to be highly contested, just given the amount of work that board staff and stakeholders and us as board members and those attending the town hall meetings and everything over the last year plus. And to Ms. Lavallo's point, there were several other rules that went to making clinicians' lives easier. And so when we hear complaints about specific things that didn't get changed, those things were part of that package and things that could have also protected the public. And so really disappointing to have to start over. And I get that's the nature of the process. And, you know, on the record, don't think you had another option. That was definitely my question during that meeting that you read the minutes for, is do we have the option to just address that one rule? And so...
shall move forward.
Yep.
And so, Madam Chair, at this time, what I would like, if you look at Agenda Item 12H,
that is the motion
that I would like somebody to consider. And the reason why it's done this way is because my communication with the governor's office was happening over the weekend.
I misunderstood something, and I put
on the agenda incorrectly. I thought that we were going to have the ability to just withdraw that one rule, but instead we had to withdraw the entire rule package.
At our meeting on Thursday,
the board voted to withdraw that rule,
but at the GIRC meeting, there was an offer of the opportunity to
with the entire rulemaking process. H is basically to ratify that decision that was made. So if somebody could make that motion and second, it would be great.
Davis moves it.
Second?
Meek second.
Either or.
Oh, yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Carries. All right. Number 14, future agenda items. I have a request to probably have a conversation regarding the FMLA disability plans, so probably the more matters issues.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add to that, that the board should consider requesting that Ms. Baskin do some research on what options that the board may have. Could this be... a policy, a substantive policy statement, or if there was another way that we can do it. I mean, clearly changing legislation isn't going to happen, especially these days. But I think or if that's something that we do, that maybe we just state, my other thought to make it even simpler is just to state the board's opinion and place it in the minutes so that board staff or others can that individual that you shouldn't bring outside of your scope. Again, I don't know what that exactly, but I think that Ms. Baskin can do research on that.
Okay, that's fine. So we'll wait for Ms. Baskin to let us know when we can add that to the agenda.
We will put it on the agenda in September.
Right.
We'll put it on the agenda in September, and if we have to, because we're not prepared, we'll do that.
Okay. Thank you. Call for public comment. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board may limit those persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any given matter. In addition, each person wishes to address the board will be given 5 minutes to do so, pursuant to ARS 38.31.01H. The board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Actions on public comment matters that are not listed on the agenda will be limited to directing staff to study the matter or to schedule a matter for further discussion at a later date. State your name and the record, please.
Hi, thank you, Chairwoman. My name is Helena Brook. I'm a licensed associate counselor and associate marriage and family therapist. First off, hello again. I was here last month kind of talking about some of the things that our coalition, which is, I don't know about so big. It's not tiny. It's been growing, which is always, it's refreshing, but it was like, wow, like it kind of blew up a bit. Does as far as like civic engagement for therapists and engaging in the process of the legislature and getting to meet with boards and commission staff and things like that. And as far as the rules, I just wanted to mention not a ton of us went to the meetings, but the recordings are available, so we had some really solid discussions about the whole work process, which was a real learning experience for all of us too. And we appreciate the fact that the board had to attend an extra meeting that Monday night and everything that you guys do. We appreciate the other associations that are sort of considered stakeholder associations at the board. But the need for this coalition kind of came about because if you look back at those town hall meetings, I think the MFTs sent someone, I think it was Casey, I don't remember who it was, but the Counseling Association and the Social Worker Association sent mailing to those town halls, which was really hard for us because we were just kind of sitting there going, well, who's going to speak? And so that's kind of why we all came together, and not just for SPP, but for people in agencies. And a lot of us in SPP have had experiences in agencies or group practices where there wasn't that accountability structure with supervision. And so I think that needs to be said. The GERC experience what our lobbyists told us, we kind of crowdsourced that, crowdfunded that, is that that she, when she spoke to the staff there, the options were pass all of the rules. Is that my timing? Okay. Pass all the rules, pass none of the rules, or pass some of the rules. And so when it didn't even come up for a vote, we joined them in their sadness for the fact that some of the really solid rules, the ones that aligned with statute, and the ones that were just really common sense and supportive of the public and professionals alike, didn't make it, and we're looking forward to those being passed. One of the things that really struck us as we were listening to the meetings was, I believe when Ms. Zavala said in, I think it was the third meeting, it was like the second study session, that there's nothing in statute or rule that actually requires associates to get supervision. It's only in furtherance of getting an independent license, but not actually serving the public. And it's really, it was hard for us to hear because we thought that it was just board policy of like not intervening if supervisors don't sign for supervision or group practices and things like that, have an associate go months without having a supervisor. And a lot of our members were like, wow, like that's why, because there's no protection written down that codifies both lower tier licensees support needs and mentorship and supervision and oversight needs, and that handholding that is so important that we saw from the national organizations. But the fact is that we, as far as we know, are the only state that doesn't have that. And a lot of the people who are in supervised private practice come to it because they were let down by a structure that doesn't have accountability. And our worries are not just with clinicians, but with the clients that we serve, because every associate should have a right to solid, accountable supervision for your nervous system, for your ethical development, but all of our clients deserve that comfort as well. You should be walking into a clinical session knowing that your clinician, if they're newer or less experienced, that they have that watchful eye. And so in furtherance of what the governor wants to do and the governor's office about trying to make things safer for the public, we're really hoping that you all as a board will look at that as well. And in addition, sorry, my notes, so it happened when the printer doesn't work. We are hoping to sort of raise more visibility about the individual stories of people who are in supervised private practice, the incredible trainings that they have, the work that they've got behind them, why they need to move into business ownership, because for a lot of people it wasn't really their first choice, and sort of bring both lived experiences and data to drive some of this stuff. Because I think we're so keen on attuning to, you know, the fear that some things might not be working in some settings, that, you know, we've really missed an opportunity to see what's going well and sort of be able to advance that as things go forward. What else did I have? Sorry. One last thing. Just looking dialectically, I know that the clinicians here will understand this, but for everybody else, the idea that we can hold both truths, that there's a lot going well, but there's a lot that can have some growth, and we're hoping that we can see that, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Agenda number 16.
I think there's another
shut-off.
One more person.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I did that last meeting, too. I apologize.
No problem.
Can you stay with me?
No, we're all anxious for lunch. So, my name is Nicholas Redgear. I'm a licensed professional counselor. I've been licensed in Arizona since 2016. I have just some comments about the FMLA paperwork, short-term disability, and some of the things that we've seen here today. I just want to say thank you. I really appreciate that that's going to be on the next agenda, and that board staff are going to be looking at that more clearly. I think that clinicians, by and large, are well-meaning. As a clinical supervisor, we both want to protect the public, but we also want to serve the public. And so we don't, as clinicians, have clear guidance. And I understand the board's position. You guys can't provide legal guidance, but if it's quite literally up to the clinician to say, okay, I call the board, I have to just go look at my scope of practice. If it's not clearly
in the scope of practice, or if there's not a substantive policy statement or some sort of opinion that makes it more clear that the board's position is very clear, we do not sign these types of things, I think you're going to have more cases where well-meaning clinicians are trying to advocate for their clients and end up getting into an area. So I think that this is a way that if we can make this more clear, that will help the clinicians, that will also help the public, and that will reduce your guys' complaints. Because I think you all, nobody wants to see complaints up here. Nobody wants to see anybody in trouble. We have a responsibility to protect the public, but I think there's a way that we can do that more efficiently. The other thing that I want to say is I work in an integrated care setting, and so I think you need to consider that, yes, we are licensed to provide psychotherapy, but we have clinicians that are in multiple settings. It's probably not appropriate for somebody who's in private practice and doesn't have regular communication with any other healthcare professional in a patient's care, right? However, I work for a company called EvolvedMD that we are integrated into primary care settings, and we practice under psychiatric collaborative care. So we are helping, we work hand-in-hand with primary care doctors. Primary care doctors look at us to be behavioral health experts. That's what we're licensed to do. But if we can't provide this kind of stuff, then we're limiting our ability to help serve those clients and also the professionals who are going to refer us to say, hey, you know, I'm primary care. Yes, I have some training in psychiatry, but you're the expert. You're the one seeing the client. Can you please assist with this? So my understanding is that it's a pretty blanket no, please do not do this. But I think if you can make it more clear, I understand that, yes, there is nuance, but if the only way to find out if you did something wrong is to end up sitting in this chair, like, that's probably not the best thing. So please, as you're doing your research, consider that. Can we include language? Can we have some sort of clarity that there may be instances where it is appropriate for, in a collaborative care way or some kind of process for that to happen, where clinicians can use some of the expertise that they have while also not practicing outside of their scope? Maybe that means co-signature. Maybe that means the PCP and the therapist collaborate, complete it together, put it in a progress note, and both sign. I don't know. Just some ideas, but I would ask the board, I'm encouraged that this is on the agenda, and I would ask the board to continue to think about these things so that we can help clinicians who do want to do right by their clients and also are not practicing outside of their scope. Thank you.
I apologize. For the record, can you spell your last name?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. R-U-D-G-E-A-R.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming forward.
My name is Twyla Webster Scott. I'm a licensed professional counselor. I don't know if this has been brought to the board yet, but, and I know there's a lot of tentacles with this question that I'm asking or requesting to put on the agenda, but it's in regards to the Rogue Sober Living Homes. And the what?
The Rogue Sober Living Homes, the shutdowns of access. And,
oh.
Are you familiar with?
Yes.
Okay. And if there could be a discussion about protections for counselors, whereas there's a situation that I'm familiar with for a peer who her license has been used multiple times in some of these homes, because, you know, you can go on the board and get someone's license and use it as far as billing and bogus billing and things like that. So I'm just wondering if there's any kind of policies or procedures or processes in place to protect us from that kind of those kinds of violations, given this situation that happened. I work for a Native American organization. We serve the Native American community predominantly, so this discussion keeps coming up with a lot of the clinicians and counselors and things like that. So I just wanted to pose that as a question to include that in the agenda in some capacity with whatever is rising in relation to protecting our license numbers in those cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else before I...
Yes. Can we add that to the future agenda in September, October for feedback on that?
Yes, and I have a lot on that. I'm sorry, for the record, can I get your name?
Twyla, T-W-Y-L-A, Webster, W-E-B-S-T-E-R.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it.
Anybody else? Okay.
I've decided.
Thank you. Okay, next meeting will be Friday, September 8th, 2023 at 9 a.m. And if any board members are not going to be able to be here, just let me know.
And do we have a confirmation from everybody that's here for September 8th? Okay.
Well, yes. And do we have a motion to end the meeting?
So move, Trotter.
Palacio, second. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Okay, meeting adjourned at 12:19. 12:20. Thank you.